You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Flashpoints. Trump's ICE force threatens mass raids in San Francisco and across California. And our flaming white supremacist president also blocks Haitians from obtaining several classes of visas. The Trumpeteers claiming without proof that the Haitians have committed high levels of fraud and abuse and have a high rate of overstaying. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilán Molina and Kevin Pina. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, I'm sure you've heard it from many sources. The ICE under Trump is threatening massive arrests. They want to arrest mayors who participate in sanctuary city actions. And the Trumpeteers are getting very serious in terms of what many are beginning to sort of call as a certain kind of ethnic cleansing, an attempt to undermine what is obviously happening in this country, which is becoming a white minority country. The battle is on. It's an extraordinary situation. And now, again, Trump's trying to make the people pay the price. Some of the people we're talking about are the folks who have kept this country going, who have done some of the hardest work, who make sure that our tables look beautiful with vegetables. I mean, I can go on and on. Obviously, this is a racist attack from the highest levels by a serial racist who now has claimed support for those good people who were protesting, those good Klan members. Yeah, that's essentially what he said. Let's start off with Ramon Cardona. He's a former official of the Salvadoran government. He knows what it's like to be on the other side of U.S. foreign policy, being forced out of your country, and now being forced out of the country that you flee to. Ramon, welcome back to Flashpoints. I imagine there are waves of fear. You have had a very busy couple of days.
Yes. Hello there. It's incredible, you know, the level of terror, because, you know, that's what I call this kind of not just threats, but actually decisions that ICE has resolved to do in California, and especially around what they say sanctuary cities and areas. Of course, many people, especially undocumented people, are listening, are hearing about this, and, you know, already they've been anguish, a level of anxiety from everything that's been going on for years, you know, not just right now since Barack Obama, but, you know, now the volume has been turned up with Donald Trump in terms of, you know, looking for people to be deported away from, you know, this country, breaking up families in, you know, how they go about doing that. And now that they are saying that they're going to do the biggest raid in history of the United States in Northern California, and having target around 1,500 individuals, and plus those who, you know, happen to be around and don't have a means to establish that they have a immigration regular status, well, they're also going to be taken along, you know, thus those others who are going to be detained. If we're getting a lot of calls at our agency here at Centro Latino Cuscatlan of people asking, is it safe to go outside? What should I do? You know, and one of the things that we've been emphasizing on people is that they have rights. They have rights. They have constitutional rights. You know, they should not be feel intimidated or fearful enough that they think, you know, anyone can just come along and do anything against to them. So again, you know, we just reiterate what we've been, you know, in our outreach work, telling them, you know, you are not obligated to speak. You know, if they ask you what country you're from, you know, you just keep silence. If they ask you, are you working, you just don't say anything. You know, you can say your name and period, and then, you know, you can go ahead and say, you know, I'm not going to speak or answer any more questions, you know, unless I have an attorney by my side. You let me call my attorney, you know, then you can ask whatever you want. But meanwhile, I'm not going to do it. And we tell them, you know, it's going to be a situation of much pressure there, much fear. You have to, you know, control yourself. You have to keep calm and know that you have rights. You have rights. You don't have to speak. You don't have to open the door unless they give you a warrant of it. And even if you're, you know, taken in, you have the right to speak to a judge. You have a right to ask for a conditional release by paying bail. So, you know, that way we're trying to appease a little bit of this fear and anguish that people are showing much more because of these threats of coming out and doing a big raid. And like you were also saying, you know, they're not just going to go against the families that are undocumented, but, you know, they're also going to hit mayors, you know, who are mayors of cities that have called sanctuary. Well, I doubt it. If, you know, I think it's just a means to terrorize, to intimidate. From an activist point of view, you know, I've been speaking to others, and, you know, what I hear is that, you know, this kind of thing is just strengthens our resolve to fight back, you know, to organize with our communities, to be, you know, next to them in these circumstances and not leave them alone.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are talking about the threats of mass raids, incredible intimidation being focused on now the West Coast, California, San Francisco. There were meetings all over the Bay Area, collections, politicians making declarations. I understand Libby Schaaf in Oakland said that she is willing to get arrested before she would cooperate. Joining us to continue the discussion is Luis Angel Salvalza. Luis, welcome to Flashpoints. I understand you're both an attorney and a dreamer. You want to give us a sense of your response to what's coming down. Obviously, Obama wasn't pleasant, but here comes Trump. Your thoughts on this crackdown and what you're hearing on the street and from the community.
Yeah, good evening. Thank you for having me. You know, first of all, I think we need to be, you know, categorical and clear when we talk about historic raids and mass raids. We need to be clear that the most and the historic number of raids that have occurred in this country occurred under a Democratic president, occurred under the Obama administration, and they occurred and took place over the course of 8 years. And it happened in a time when there was a Democratic president, and for the first 2 years of that presidency, the Democrats had control for both chambers of Congress and promised immigration reform, promised a lot of relief, not only to immigrants, but to working class people across the United States and to black and to the black community, given the historical meaning of his election. And he went back on everything, but was very successful at co-opting many of the mainstream organizations that were tied to the Democratic Party. And by co-opting many of those organizations, was able to covertly and what we call, you know, midnight raids, raids that happened in the shadows, that happened in the dark, took place across the country in a devastating, the devastating severity where nearly 3 million people were deported under the Obama administration. So when we talk about mass raids and we talk about historic raids that are being, you know, reported now, we need to make sure that we understand that deportation machine was expanded and and was really created and sophisticated in a way that had not been seen before, even under the Bush administration, by a Democrat and by the Obama administration. And this is the machine that the Trump administration has now inherited. The attacks that the Trump administration is announcing or that are being reported from ICE by Trump are not a surprise. It is something that we have expected, and the immigrant community, not only here in the Bay Area and in California, but across the country, has been preparing since the Obama administration to fight back and to organize and to fight power with community power. And this has been a reality for immigrants since the Obama administration. If there's any silver lining to the Trump administration coming into power, is that it has exposed the inhumane nature of the immigration system and of really the hypocrisy of American democracy, that, you know, despite the rhetoric, despite the elections that happen every 4 years and every so often, there's still a ruling class that makes decisions, and there's a business class that needs to coerce and needs to discipline labor, and disciplining one of the most oppressed sectors of the working class, like immigrants, and scapegoating them for problems that have more to do with Wall Street is something very common. And so we expected all of this, and at least now it's been exposed to a much larger layer of the American public. So, yes, the mass raids are announced. There's a lot of conversations about fear and about how the immigrant community is gonna respond to this, but there's a couple of things that I think are important to keep in mind. One is fear is a tactic that the government is using, and so we need to be very careful about projecting more fear into the community. Immigrants are not inherently afraid. Immigrants are to the contrary. Leaving your home country, leaving everything behind, and being compelled many times by the foreign policies of this country to come to this country, to a foreign country where you're not wanted, where you're exploited, where there's a different language, and to leave everything behind requires leaving fear behind. Every single day that we leave and we go outside to work, we go to school, we take our children to school is an act of fearlessness that the immigrant community exercises every single day. And what we're doing now and organizing is leaning on that fearlessness that the immigrant community inherently has to have in order to survive every single day. And so since the Trump administration and before then, we have been preparing for moments like this. And what we have in place right now, at least here in the Bay Area, but also across the country, are something that we call rapid response networks, where organizers, directly impacted people, and attorneys are coming together in this rapid response network, so that when these raids happen, not only are we able to send attorneys to these detention centers to make sure that we protect the due process rights of immigrants, but that we also have organizers and community members out in the streets fighting power with power, organizing a working class, and if need be, having to organize our collective strength in the economy to organize walkouts, to organize shutdowns, so that this government and the people that control this government can understand that they will not get away with exploiting, scapegoating immigrants in this country any longer.
And what about the targeting of activists such as yourself? That must be of a great concern, because we're seeing that already.
That's right. We have heard very alarming news in New York City with some historic leaders in the immigrant rights movement being, a Haitian man was deported. Rock v. New York, and historic organizer and leader of the New Sanctuary Coalition, being detained just this last week in New York City. There was also an activist that was recently served with a notice to appear, which commences removal proceedings against her because of her political mobilizations and her political activism as an undocumented organizer. But these are, again, tactics to try to take out leaders in the immigrant rights movement. But for every leader that this administration targets, there's 10, 20, hundreds of more leaders that are born every single day by these actions. So this, to me, is an act of desperation from the government. The more that the government does these sort of actions, the more that it exposes the true nature of this country. And what the Trump administration is doing right now is serving to educate masses of people about the true nature of the democracy that we live in. And so, yes, these are difficult times, but the conversations and the organizing that's happening locally and in the community is truly uplifting, and it's what keeps me and I think a lot of people hopeful, you know. And a lot of this organizing is happening by some of the most oppressed sectors of our own communities. We're talking about Black undocumented people organizing, queer undocumented people organizing, and most of these efforts being led, in fact, by women on the ground. And that's where we really draw our strength. And so, yes, they're attacking us. Yes, it's alarming that this administration is doing all of this. We live in historic times, and we have a very resilient community that is taking very concrete steps to organize. A lot of this organizing happening, you know, oftentimes simmers below the surface for obvious reasons, because we must be vigilant that the government is watching. But I think, you know, this country needs to be ready for what's coming from the response from the community itself.
And what's your personal situation? Are you in jeopardy?
You know, you mentioned the word dreamer, and I just, you know, I want to make this clear for the listeners. There's been a lot of conversations about what's the political identity of undocumented youth. So, you know, yes, I came to this country when I was 8 years old. I'm a recipient of DACA, and that's what has allowed me to practice as an attorney and to be able to represent immigrants that honestly are no different than I am. And I know that any day I could see my parents, or I could see myself, you know, behind, you know, a glass window, or I could be in detention center myself or speaking to my loved ones. So that irony doesn't escape my clients. But yeah, DACA is what has allowed me to do this. But the reason that I do this is not, this temporary protection that was won by, again, fights and direct actions of undocumented youth. And so a lot of us have rejected the term dreamer, in that it creates a narrative of deserving versus undeserving immigrants. And in many ways, this narrative played into the politics of President Obama, and that he was able to say that, look, we're deporting felons, not families. We're deporting felons, not dreamers. And we have learned from that, from those mistakes. And today we say all immigrants are real refugees, whether economic refugees because of the policies of this country or otherwise. And every immigrant has rights, and every immigrant deserves the ability to move and the ability to repopulate the earth in different regions out of necessity. And so, yeah, my situation itself is uncertain. But it's uncertain for all undocumented people, and I've been undocumented before. And if DACA was to go away in March, and right now, we're having this conversation that there's a looming government shutdown, you know, on the horizon.
Do we know if the Democrats are willing to hold the line for DACA?
Well, we're going to see a lot of. There's been a lot of organizing by undocumented youth across the country. We had actions here holding both Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in the House of Representatives, and also holding Senator Feinstein and Senator Harris, and a whole view of a whole array of Democrats accountable, because they weren't there when Obama was deporting record numbers of immigrants. And so whatever happens today, I think there's a big, it's a big testament to the organizing of undocumented youth, of being fearless, and most importantly, being independent politically, of holding both Democrats and Republicans accountable. I think it's historic that we're in a situation today where there is a looming government shutdown, and it's because of the DREAM Act. This has placed at the center of the entire national debate an issue that for many years has been ignored. And so it's historic all unto its own, regardless of what happens today, you know, with the vote. And we need to be also clear that the DREAM Act is not going to address the issue for the entire immigrant community. It's a stepping stone for more gains to be able to protect the rights of all immigrants, not just those that were brought to this country as youth. But it's an important development, and it's a true testament to the organizing potential of immigrants when we come together and rely on ourselves and our allies in the working class, in the Black community, and in the queer and LGBTQ community as well.
All right. Well, we want to thank you, Luis Angel Zavalza. We also appreciate Ramon Cardona. Both of you have really added to our knowledge of what's going on. We wish you the best. We're going to stay very close to the story. And coming up for the rest of the broadcast, we're going to be focusing on the impact on Haitians. Our senior producer, who spent many years in Haiti and is deeply engaged in the politics there, has a lot to say. Guests on the line coming right out of Haiti. All this coming straight ahead on Flashpoints. Do not turn away. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Flashpoint senior producer Kevin Pina. Kevin knows as much about Haiti as just about anybody in this world, has spent many years there reporting on the ground, putting his life on the line to counteract the big lie of mainstream reporting. And so often it has been a big lie and really an arm of the State Department. Kevin, we've seen a couple of things going on. We saw the temporary status removed from the Haitians, and now
temporary protected status. 60,000 Haitians affected.
And now the Trumpeteers have announced that they're blocking Haitians from being able to obtain certain
temporary
key,
work visas.
Temporary work visas. These are visas where people end up saving the lives of their family and also doing incredible work here in the United States. But the Trump folks say high levels of fraud. Those Haitians, you can't trust them. Abuse, and they're always overstaying.
Well, it is a difficult but not so complex story, and I just got to correct you. I think my guests are actually more versed than me on Haiti, although I know a lot. I think they know more, and that's why we always have this quality of people here on Flashpoints. We've got Jocelyn Gay, who is a member of an organization called Kakula, which is an organization that works directly with grassroots groups in Haiti. Jocelyn Gay, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
And we also have on the line our good friend, Fran Jerome. He's the Flashpoints political analyst. He's coming to us from that other coast. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Franz. Franz, you there? Well, I don't know if Franz is there. How about you, Orlando Opont, investigative journalist, Haitian journalist?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be there.
Thank you.
We'll see if we... happy to share.
Oh, Franz, you there?
Yes, this is Franz Jerome. I'm happy to be with you.
Excellent. Well, I want to start with you, Jocelyn. You've been in New York. I know that Orlando has as well, but I want to start with Jocelyn Gay. There have been massive protests in Brooklyn, thousands and thousands of Haitians hitting the streets, protesting Donald Trump's remarks about Haiti. On the other hand, we also know that the issue is far more complex because whereas we might not agree with the remark that Donald Trump made, we also know that it is not a paradise that's happening in Haiti by virtue of the current government that's in power there. Jocelyn?
Yes, definitely. But why would you have the nerve and not being decent and call your neighbor asshole because your neighbor is poor, especially when your empire is responsible for the poverty?
Well, and you don't want to grab that tiger by the tail, as we've seen with the thousands and thousands of Haitians who are out in the streets, right?
Under 15 on Martin Luther King's Day, there was a huge one, and then today we've had hundreds went over the Brooklyn Bridge to 40 Wall Street to tell Donald Trump that, hey, we know that he's a representative of an empire that is just a mouthpiece. He's the filthy mouthpiece, but even if your mouth is sweet or filthy, you're the representative of the empire that caused a lot of countries to be impoverished, and Haiti is definitely one of them.
And let me bring you in here, Franz, really quickly. There is also this question that, you know, Donald Trump made this statement. Obviously, that's over the top, outrageous, and insulting. No one should accept that kind of insult. However, we also know that the current regime in Haiti has not created conditions where Haitians would be comfortable coming back, right? It's not as if from since the earthquake, there hasn't been enough funds or there hasn't been enough resources to be able to build Haiti back better.
The resources were stolen, if you remember, since the earthquake 8 years ago. Just remember that Martelly and the present regime, they were imposed on Haiti. But for the longest time, the U.S. just come in and put their puppet. And that's the next puppet. This is the same party, the political party that Martelly was there. The current president is in the same.
The PHTK party.
Yeah, PSTK and PSTK. And now what they do is just come in and then put the money in their pocket and run. This is what the U.S. Empire does everywhere. Breaks down your country and then find the worst among you that doesn't have any vision for your country and then put the person in power. And then they come to the country to pillage the leftover wealth that you have and make it difficult for your citizens to go back to the infrastructure of your country and then and they blame you for being a victim.
Yeah, I've often said, you know, they come in and they break your furniture and then they accuse you of being, a bad housekeeper. But let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of Jocelyn Gay. She's a member of Kakula, which is an organization that works directly with grassroots groups in Haiti. And we're discussing President Trump's insulting remarks about Haiti and Haitians. But we're also talking about the real conditions inside of the country. Franz, are you there? I want to bring you into this conversation because, you know, clearly... again, I'll say it. It's not like since the earthquake, there hasn't been enough resources to build back Haiti better. Why is it that the conditions aren't better in that country? In your country?
I think that it was a deliberate move to put the Martelly gang in power in Haiti so that they could waste the money that the funds that the world population had so willingly provided for the reconstruction of Haiti,
and that was under the Democrats, right? That was under Obama when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State in 2010.
Well, the policy is the political parties may change, but the policy of the United States on Haiti has always been the same, and it's always very consistent. And one thing that apparently everybody agrees on when it comes to the political attitude of the United States towards Haiti is that they must be in control. So they went in there, they selected the people that were going to implement the corrupt system that is currently in place. Because remember, it goes back all the way back to 2004 and maybe even before 2004 in 1991 when they implemented the last two coups. It was to stop a government that were believed to be honest government in general by the population, and also governments that were trying to use limited resources in order to rehabilitate the country. Especially in 2004, Haiti had not received any aid from the foreign or the international community, yet they had implemented many work projects and also housing programs, et cetera, et cetera, besides the schools that were going up, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, that's what was stopped in 2004. So, and it was replaced by a systematic
a looting of the resources of Haiti, especially after the earthquake of 2010.
And a military intervention by United Nations forces, right?
Well, the occupation of the United Nations, the United Nations listens to only certain people. You know the structure of the United. So they were doing the bidding of the powers that control the United Nations.
Well, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're having a discussion about Haiti and the recent remarks that Donald Trump, insulting remarks he made about Haiti and Haitians. But we're also talking about the real conditions in the country. I just kind of want to sum this up before I bring Orlando Opontin here, Haitian investigative journalist, which is we've got the earthquake in 2010, then we've got NGOs, and that includes the Clinton Foundation, everyone from the Clinton Foundation to Sean King, raising billions of dollars, and the international community raising billions of dollars. And a lot of that aid just simply disappears. We know that it doesn't go to Haiti. The Red Cross scandalously uses the money to their money, $30 million of it, to buy land, to build another $70 million, to build a luxury hotel. There's a lot of controversy around that. A lot of the aid money wasted. But we also, that same year, have then Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton of the Obama administration intervene and fix the 2010 presidential elections, which brought the PHTK to power, and they themselves then began to feed at the trough. Very well-known corruption within the PHTK under then-President Martelly. And then, of course, there's a second set of elections in 2015, which are stolen not once, but twice, two rounds of fraud. And the United States and the international community ultimately shove the PHTK back down the throats of the Haitian people. And now they're back absconding funds. We're seeing very little done in terms of infrastructure within the country. But we're hearing a lot of Haitian parliamentarians bragging about their new houses and their new cars. And some of them, I'll say, I've even seen it on the internet, bragging about their mistresses. And now we're at the situation where they're saying that Haiti has done better, that 60,000 Haitians no longer are going to be given temporary protective status by virtue of the earthquake, and that another 20,000 are longer going to be can no longer apply for temporary work visas. And, of course, we know that the conditions in the country still remain very bad, but not because there wasn't resources to fix it. Am I right, Orlando Opontin?
Yes, you're very right. Kevin, but one thing I want to add, because I would like to look at the statement of Donald Trump at a different angle. His statement is not just a statement. That was the president of the United States of America, and setting policies with Parliament, with senators, people in the Parliament of the United States of America.
As a matter of fact, in the Congress, yes.
In Congress. As a matter of fact, we see exactly those policies. That's the way they have been conducting business. That's the way they have been treating Haiti. And as said, you can see that's what is happening. And this is not just happening. This is something from day one, on January 1st, 1904. 1804, when we declare our independence, presidents like George Washington, Jefferson, name them. That is the policy. They have been imposing a lot of hostile sanctions against Haiti. We're not at war with nobody. However, there have been diplomatic quarantine. There have been invasions, so many invasions, trade barriers. You can name it. They have been treating Haiti just like Donald Trump said. And when Donald Trump was talking, he was setting policies, my brother. And the thing that hurt the most, to see those criminals those indicted criminals that they impose on the Haitian people, those indicted government that are indicted, my brothers and sisters, indicted criminals.
But you're talking about the PHTK party that's currently in power.
I'm talking about the president. I'm talking about
Jovenel Moïse.
I'm talking about some of the senators. I mean, Jovenel Moïse. They are indicted criminals in a court of law. And that is to say, when he say we are treating Haiti like such, so those people don't even say a word. I mean, any decent government would call America and request that they cancel any treaty, any accord from 1891 to today to review them to make sure that that relationship with America is not as Donald Trump said.
Orlando, let me get some. I just want to clarify one thing. If I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that Donald Trump's statements represent a long trajectory of racist thought of U.S. policy towards Haiti, and that includes their having brought to power and keeping in power the current PHTK, which is made up of indicted criminals, as you said.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly what I'm saying. And I want to say, also, any decent government, I mean, if you have a government like the one elected by the people, trust me, this is an opportunity to really ask the whole world to stand with Haiti and to make sure those racist, those inhuman policies that violate all international law be stopped. And also, it is an opportunity for any decent government really to review their whole relationship with the United States of America. However, putting drug dealers, people, I mean, criminals, assassins, who are massacred the people of Haiti. We just had a massacre of the United Nations against the people of Haiti. People who have nothing to do. They just wake up, go about their business for 6 hours. Ministers have been killing, decent people, in their home, going to work. This is the policy that the United States of America is using to conduct business with Haiti.
Well, let me just remind our listeners, Orlando, that they're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Kevin Pina, senior producer of the program. I have on the line right now, we've been speaking with Haitian investigative journalist Orlando Opont. We also have on the line Flashpoints political analyst Fran Jerome, as well as Jocelyn Gay, a member of Kakula, an organization that works directly with grassroots groups in Haiti. Let me go back to Jocelyn, to you real quickly again here, because I understand that the Democratic Party is now trying to co-opt this anger of the Haitian community throughout the United States against Trump's racist remarks aimed toward Haiti and Haitians. We see, for example, a well-known Democratic operative, Patrick Gaspard, who's the former U.S. ambassador to South Africa, who, as I recall, his main job was to make sure that the democratically elected President Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide, who was overthrown in a coup in 2004 and was forced into exile in South Africa, Patrick Gaspard's main job was making sure that he could not return to his own country, return to Haiti, despite tens of thousands of people in the streets demanding his return and being killed during those protests. Now Patrick Gaspard is the symbol of the Democratic Party trying to co-opt the anger of the Haitian diaspora here in the United States. Jocelyn, what's your view of that?
Suddenly Mr. Gaspard remembered that he's Haitian. Come on. I mean, we know that he was serving a deporter-in-chief. All right, Obama had a sweet tongue, as I said, as a representative of the same empire, but he was deporting people, and he didn't say anything. As they when they were coming for people, other people, then he didn't say anything. Now they're coming for him. Okay, he's lucky that it doesn't have DACA or TPS, because they would have been out of there a long time ago. I don't know if you know about this gentleman called Jean-Juan Trouville, who's Haitian, and then they just discarded him. He just made a mistake a while ago, went to jail and paid his dues, hasn't done anything since then that is illegal, and then they're just deporting him. Well, this is what's going on, and it's been going on before Trump, and Trump just happened to be a sewer, and sewage came out of his mouth. But he's still the representative of the same empire who's been, that empire has been breaking other people's countries, making it impossible for them to go back home, and then blaming them for being refugees and migrating. This is what this country has been doing forever, and they haven't stopped. I hope they had since I was asleep last night, but that's their MO. And they haven't stopped. So Mr. Gaspar, now he's all huffing and puffing, and then he was pretty quiet when the same thing was happening before Donald Trump. Donald Trump happens to be somebody who doesn't. We have an expression in Haiti that says, "Ousselam me opasire kras." You're the sea, and then you cannot really hide all the garbage that is in the sea. And Donald Trump is just the mouthpiece of all the garbage that is in the sea of the Empire of America. But it's been going on. It's been an empire, and it's been breaking down countries, and Haiti happens to be one of them, especially. We had the nerve to take the realistic call, Haiti Boyo Kiskeya, from the colonialists and the imperialists, and they didn't like it. Hey, that's a very good, a very productive realistic that we took from them. That little land, and this is the same land that is still there, made friends multi-zillionaire, and in this country like it too. They go into with their factories to exploit people and give them squalor salaries, and then they love it. And this is what they've been doing, and they are trying to take the leftover gold and every wealth that we have in the soil. They're trying to take the leftover. They haven't changed. As I said, while I was asleep last night. So Mr. Gaspar should stop huffing and puffing, because he's been a representative of them for quite a while.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of Jocelyn Gay. She's a member of CACOLA, an organization that works directly with grassroots organizations in Haiti. We're discussing the situation in Haiti. We're discussing remarks by Trump. We're discussing the removal of temporary protected status for more than 60,000 Haitians. Also, that Haitians now have been added to a new list, which is they can no longer apply for what are called temporary work visas to come to the United States. Franz, I want to bring you back into this discussion because, you know, in 2004, the Bush administration overthrew the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And the United States, over the years since then, has stepped in and they've taken responsibility for, they say, training the police force, for arming the police force, for helping to train the judiciary to make judges more honest. So on one hand, while they've said that they respect Haitian sovereignty, the United States has really taken a big hand in trying to reshape Haiti's political landscape since the coup of 2004. So don't they have a large responsibility for whatever Haiti is today?
Well, as they say, you break it, you fix it, you own it. But most importantly, you know, in 2004, we were told that the police was being politicized by the Lavalas government. And then they took over the police from 3,000 policemen that had a fairly stable country in 2003-2002 to, I believe, well above 15,000 nowadays, and they cannot control the country because more corruption in the police, more instability. But even if the police does its work, its job, like Orlando just mentioned, you have a situation where the judges, the Justice Department is dominated by the political players of PHTK. I like to call them skinheads, but, you know...
Skinheads?
They are skinheads because that they are...
Tetkale means, you know, yeah.
Tetkale. So, it's French symbolism. But they are definitely in the business of creating an army and paramilitary forces to dominate the country, dominate the people, and repress the people. Now, the main order of business in for the United States and the rest of the international community is to create these repressive forces in Haiti. And also, besides that, when under President Préval, the legislature raised the salary to $3 a day, it was the United States on behalf of the owners of factories, the factory owners in Haiti, that pressured President Préval and told him not to promulgate the law and exerted a lot of pressure on him. So they create all the conditions, the repression, the repressive forces, and the subhuman wages for people to leave the country, and then they turn around and say, well, these people are too poor, these people want to come here and stay, et cetera, et cetera. So basically what I'm trying to say is that they play a big, big role in creating the poverty in Haiti.
U.S. foreign policy. U.S. foreign policy.
In keeping salaries low. And two, in making it impossible for people to be at peace long enough so that they could organize themselves and pull themselves from the bootstraps. You have to realize that one of the characteristics of repressive governments is that they outlaw organizations because they don't let people organize to present their desires. So if you cannot organize to present your desires, then you basically are in a condition where you cannot express your political will. And that's the condition that the international community, with the imposed UN occupation, have created in today's Haiti. And that's why the criminals that Orlando Opel mentioned can control Haiti. Because you remember many times last year I came on the show to talk about the assault against the people, especially of Gonaïves and Alcaye and the land that the Martelly government wanted to steal because they were changing the geographic definition of Haiti so that they could create a department just for themselves.
And they did steal it.
There's Alcaye. And a lot of people died. But nobody has been brought to justice for those crimes.
Well, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of our guest, Fran Jerome. He's a Flashpoints political analyst. We're discussing the situation in Haiti as well as U.S. foreign policy and the Trump administration's policy that has ended temporary protection status for more than 60,000 Haitians as well as more than 20,000 Haitians who are no longer eligible for so-called H-2 work visas to come into the United States. We also have on the line with us Orlando Opont, who's an investigative journalist. Orlando, I really quickly, I've got about 5 minutes and I want to bring Jocelyn back in to help wrap this up and maybe another short word from Franz. But Orlando, really quickly, I hear Paul Altidor, who is the Haitian ambassador to the United States. I hear other PHTK officials of what is well known to be a very corrupt government. Haiti now is the third worst country in the world to do business in, according to Transparency, an organization called Transparency International, because of the high levels of government corruption. But what about the PHTK government, this corrupt government, now crying about Trump's statements and trying to make themselves out to be part of the victims when, in fact, they are the real predators in Haiti?
Yes. They're not only the real predator, but let me tell you, it's like they do not have. It's like the first minister is saying one thing, Altibo is saying another thing. The minister of foreign affairs, the secretary of state, is saying another thing, and what we can see. These people, they're not only criminals, they're also incompetent. And they're also enemy of the people. When you look at people, I mean, you mentioned Patrick Gaspar. Patrick Gaspar associated himself with those criminals. I would like to ask Patrick Gaspar.
He's an inside operative of the Democratic Party.
That's what I'm asking. I would like to ask him, does he know how many people lost their lives in 2003, 2004, 2005? How many innocent people his action as a Democrat, his action as a union member killed in Haiti? We're talking about thousands of people. When Patrick Gaspar associated himself with these people, and he knew, as a matter of fact, but at that time, he was the Bush administration. And I don't know if Obama understood and realized when he associated himself with Patrick Gaspar, what he was heading into. I mean, this Patrick Gaspar, I mean, he was, I think, money. I don't think we can associate him with anything else but money, because he was an associate of all those criminals and PHTK.
What about this sort of phony nationalism that these guys are hiding behind now? Oh, you can't do that to Haiti. We are a proud and independent country. And yet at the same time, their positions, their corrupt positions, directly come from the approval of the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince.
Got it.
Well, we know, as a matter of fact, those gentlemen, they're not talking on behalf of the Haitian people. We know definitely they were imposed on the people, and the people of Haiti have no respect for them. So what they're saying, and I'm saying, what they're saying makes no sense. Because we know very clearly who they are. And at the same token, you can see the first minister of this government say, Donald Trump say he didn't say it. Donald Trump didn't say nothing. Just the statement of the first minister of government. When the whole world stand against the declaration of Donald Trump. But we have the chief of government of Haiti stating, saying Donald Trump didn't say nothing. Even Donald Trump saying he used some strong language. But for the first minister of Haiti, he didn't say nothing. However, yes, Altidore and others are hiding. But they know they are enemies of the nation. When they're going to be an elected government by the people, those guys will be tried for high treason, and they will pay the price, because it's not staying like that. The people of Haiti are awakening right now, and we're not going to stop. The people of Haiti should take their own destiny into their own head. Right now, it's time for us to organize ourselves and to respond to Donald Trump. I mean, the response will come from the people, not from those traitors. The response will come from the Haitian people, because let me tell you something. they can try to erase anything they want to. Even God cannot erase history. As powerful as fire can be, it never goes swimming in the river. And the law of our people, the truth, the discipline, the morality, the ethic of the ancient people will prevail. Will prevail because we know those criminals, we know those traitors, we know them. And Donald Trump could say as much as he can say. As the President of the United States, he's setting his policy. But the people will review the whole policy of Donald Trump. And Haiti, he won't be able to treat Haiti like he planned to do.
Well, I doubt he's ever going to make a trip to Haiti. That's for darn sure. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of our guest, Haitian investigative journalist Orlando Aponte. I also have on the line Franz Jerome, Flashpoints political analyst, and Jocelyn Gay, a member of Kakula. Franz, you got a minute, and then I want to bring Jocelyn in to wrap this up. What is your opinion of that, about the posturing of the Haitian government?
Well, you always heard me refer to them as lackeys of the international community. They have not been elected by the people. It is a stretch to call them the government of Haiti. They have been elected by international, therefore they are representatives of the international community. So it's only normal that they make excuses for the aggressions, verbal aggressions towards Haitians. However, you know, I will say that Haitian organizations will continue to push and make sure that Haitian sense of dignity and the self-esteem of young Haitians prevails and puts them out of the reach of people who want to do harm to not only their psyche, but also to them physically.
And finally, Jocelyn Gay, help us let's wrap this up and help us make sense of where we go from here. I think we've raised a lot of important topics and covered a lot of ground.
Definitely. Hi, friends, and Orlando. Happy New Year. So definitely, the U.S. Government, I call it the empire, has never changed their spot. That animal never changed their spot. We had the apologizer-in-chief, Clinton, who destroyed the economy of Haiti by importing cheap rice to keep the peasants from really feeding themselves. We have the deporter-in-chief, Obama, who deported a lot of people, as they say, more people than everybody before him. And then now we have the asshole-in-chief. So they're doing exactly the same thing, Haiti. Nobody wants to leave paradise and go someplace else if they can live there. Haiti has been emerging of its citizens for a long time. Canada has been taking a lot of our brains. France has been taking a lot of our brains, too, and definitely the United States. Nobody wants to leave their country when you can live there. You cannot live there because something is keeping you from living there, and it's usually the empire's imperialism that gets into your country and makes it impossible. They love our labor. They rave on the hardworking Haitians in Haiti so that they can go with their factories and give you $5 a day. Caracol, the last of their project in the north of the country, is totally upside down because a lot of people, since they started the factory, the people in Caracol have been protesting against the slave labor wage that they are giving to them. So this is their MO, and the last time I checked, they haven't changed their MO. And Mr. Trump is just, as I said, the filthiest representative of the empire. He just happened to have a sewer mouth, and then he says what he said. And I do not, guys, we don't have to defend our integrity and dignity in front of Trump because he doesn't have any. If he had some dignity, I would try to defend my against them. We know who we are. We know what we did. We got ourselves out of slavery while they had slaves here, so we don't have to defend our dignity. And as I said, there's no justification for anybody. While you have a neighbor who's poor or doesn't have anything, doesn't have a job or something like that, to call them assholes. There's no justification. You have no empathy. You your humanity is in the toilet. So that's it. So this is a poor reflection on him. It's not a poor reflection on us. Haiti is what it is. There are, thanks to the policies of the U.S., rape, murder, thief, theft, and so on and so forth. And once we, if we don't organize, they'll continue doing the same thing like they did it. They broke down Libya, Iraq.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Again, that's the voice of Jocelyn Gay, member of Kakula, an organization that works directly with grassroots in Haiti. Thank you for joining us, Fran Jerome, Flashpoint's political analyst and Haitian investigative journalist Orlando Opont. Thank you so much for joining us tonight here on another edition of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. As our corporate media bang the Iran war drums louder and louder and treat the presidential candidates as though they were thinkers and statesmen instead of clowns, we'll turn for some perspective to that fine journalist, filmmaker, and thinker, John Pilger. Pilger shows how the news media act as the propaganda arm of established power and some of the ways we can fight back. I hope you'll stay tuned. In August 2008, John Pilger gave a speech at the Melbourne Writers' Festival in his native Australia. He speaks of how the establishment press aids and abets established power in its undemocratic, bad, and even illegal policies, specifically the establishment's illegal wars. One of the press's chief ways of doing this, Pilger calls censorship by omission. You simply don't report the true facts that contradict the official balderdash. In America now, we're seeing this with a vengeance in the case of the phony Iran crisis. Facts like Iran has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Everything Iran does with radioactive materials is closely monitored by UN observers. The observers report they found no evidence of any materials being used to develop weapons. The U.S.'s major spy agencies have reported in writing that they see no evidence of an Iranian bomb development program. Iran has every right to enrich uranium to the point where it's useful for medical research. To enrich it to bomb-making levels would require a huge increase in uranium supply and in infrastructure. It could not possibly go undetected. Those are some of the facts just about Iran that rarely get reported. Why not? But let's cut to Pilger and a slightly condensed version of his fine 2008 talk in Melbourne, Power, Propaganda, and the Silence of Writers.
There's an important element of black farce in what we do as journalists and writers, and especially in the pretensions of the high and mighty, who depend on us to promote their ambitions and to cover their omissions. Now, this requires an empathy with humanity, with us, with our frailties, absurdities, and above all, our rights, along with a deep skepticism of those who exercise power over us. The critical element here is memory. According to the American magazine Time, we now live in what's called an eternal present. It's as if the task of journalists and writers is to keep us fixated on the ephemeral and to limit our horizons to our navels. Look at me, woe is me, page after page of McFreud. It's as if our past exists only as self-serving nostalgia, especially in Australia. And yet what makes Australia different and interesting, its ancient people and the achievements of its political upstarts, have been subjected to an organized forgetting. Who knows the uniqueness of Aboriginality? Who knows that true national independence and pride comes not from gold medals, but understanding the secrets of our own country and doing right by our first people? Who knows that hope and inspiration for our young people come not from flags and the rituals of the 25th of April, but from, for example, the women who led the popular movement to stop soldiers being sent to the slaughter of 1914-18, and they won. For Kevin Rudd to say that there's no higher calling, as he did the other day, than the military, is either stupidity or cynicism, take your pick. Who knows that Australians won the world's first 35-hour working week, half a century ahead of Europe and America, along with the world's first pension and child benefits and minimum wage, all of which are the bedrock of your prosperity and mine? It's as if our political imagination is something to be pacified, not primed. Our two main parties are now virtually identical. They form a facade behind which their shared assumptions are no longer open, it seems, to serious challenge. The role of the media is critical in maintaining this. We have democracy by media, just as we have war by media, culture by media, trial by media, patriotism by media, and silence by media. In this way, the boundaries of so much of public debate are fixed. In almost everything we see, hear, and read in the media, political doctrine is insinuated as a presupposition. Without irony, this is called free speech. In fact, it's censorship by omission. Now let's consider these omissions, these silences. The social and cultural destruction of a whole nation, Iraq, is well underway. It's a Holocaust. At least 1 million people have died. And that figure comes on top of the 1 million Iraqis who died as a result of the blockade of the 1990s in which Australia took part. According to UNICEF, 500,000 Iraqi children never reached the age of 5. Does anyone remember these children? I thought about them when I watched the evening news on which happy Australian families farewelled their loved ones in the Navy as they sailed off to impose that murderous blockade. I thought about these children last Tuesday when the media again showed tearful Navy families as HMAS Parramatta sailed off to take part in what the Sydney Morning Herald called the rehabilitation of Iraq. Rehabilitation? Really? Children die in Iraq, in their hospitals there, because there are no syringes, no surgical gloves, no life-saving drugs, none of the things we take for granted on this cozy winter's night. During all the years of the slave trade, the death toll was less than the carnage in Iraq in the past 17 years. We have no sense of this Holocaust in Australia. With a few honourable exceptions, there are no politicians, no writers, no journalists, no academics speaking out, calling us to account. Just silence. Having denounced the lies of his predecessor, Kevin Rudd is silent about the lie that his government is withdrawing from Iraq. In fact, less than half the number of Australians are coming home. How does this propaganda of silence actually work? After all, it's a media society we live in, one with a lot of media noise. Well, a few months ago, President Bush's former spokesman, Scott McClellan, confessed that almost everything he said about Iraq on behalf of Bush was a lie. What was interesting about this confession was the way McClellan described the journalists who put out his lies. He called them complicit enablers. What he was saying, in effect, was that the media's echoing of Bush's lies and Blair's lies and Howard's lies made the attack on Iraq possible. Let's look at another way. Let's imagine that we journalists in free societies had done our job, that we challenged and revealed and set the record straight. Had we done that, perhaps a million people might be alive today. In his classic work, Obedience to Authority, the psychologist Stanley Milgram wrote this, and I quote, "There's always some element of bad form in objecting to the destructive course of events, or indeed in making it a topic of conversation. Thus, in Nazi Germany, even among those most closely identified with the final solution, it was considered an act of discourtesy to talk about the killings." Unquote. Do you recognize that bad form, that discourtesy? Take the war on terror. 9/11 and Bali were gross acts of terrorism, but they were tiny compared with the state terrorism carried out in our name and which is almost never reported that way. Since 1945, the United States has overthrown 50 governments, many of them democracies. Liberation movements have been crushed, people in straw houses bombed. In Cambodia, 750,000 peasants were bombed to death before Pol Pot took power. All that is documented. Do we regard this terror as terror? Do we regard the siege of Fallujah in Iraq as terror, in which thousands were killed and maimed and in an utterly pointless attack? Do we regard as terror the enforced starvation of Gaza? Do we regard daily threats against the 17 million people of Iran as terror? The American reporter Seymour Hersh described the other day how the White House was trying to provoke Iran into defending itself. One idea of Vice President Cheney was to build a fleet of PT boats like the ones the Iranian Navy has, put Americans in them dressed as Iranian sailors, and let them start a shoot-up with American ships. "That should do it," said Cheney. Fortunately, it was pointed out to the Vice President that this would mean Americans killing Americans, and his plan was rejected. Hersh says his magazine, The New Yorker, refuses to publish this important story of black farce. That's how censorship works, by omission. Last November, the National Intelligence Estimate, representing the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, published a report on Iran. "We judge with high confidence," said the report, "that in fall 2003, Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program," unquote. Yet turn on the radio or TV, pick up a newspaper, and it's as if this inconvenient truth did not exist. The drumbeat has started. Iraq deja vu. War by journalism. Afghanistan is promoted as a good war. In fact, it's a very bad war. A PR exercise to make Americans feel better after 9/11 and to cover the fact that Osama bin Laden had got away. The cost of this stunt was, according to an investigation by the London Guardian, 20,000 innocent lives. There's also the matter of the strategic control of the energy-rich Caucasus, but that's rarely mentioned. The news is that the good war is drawing the line against evil. There's no human enemy, no national resistance, only something called the Taliban. The Taliban are bad. We are good. Australian diggers are heroes, yet again. That's the story. But what exactly are we and our allies doing in Afghanistan? On the day I wrote these words, American planes had slaughtered yet another wedding party, 47 people, mostly women and children. Wedding parties are a specialty of our side, So far, we've bombed to bits four of them. To many of us, on this cosy Melbourne night, that didn't happen. Nothing ever happened, to quote Harold Pinter, of crimes committed in our name. Even while it was happening, it wasn't happening. It didn't matter. It was of no interest. Last year, 26,000 troops, mostly Americans, invaded the beautiful, fragile landscape around Shoalwater Bay in Queensland. Stealth aircraft bombed, and the U.S. 7th Fleet fired live missiles and exploded depth charges in areas where endangered species live. Indeed, they blasted away some of the most amazing biodiversity in Australia. This week, we've had copious media on the plight of a baby whale. But we've heard nothing about the high-frequency devastation of the sonar of countless whales during this military exercise, and it was the biggest military exercise in Australia since the Second World War. We heard nothing about it. It didn't happen. It didn't happen even when it was happening. It was of no interest.
On New World Notes, we're hearing John Pilger on power, propaganda, and the silence of writers. A couple quick notes on the next section. The Australian government is doing to the country's Aboriginal people now pretty much what the United States government did to our country's Aboriginal people in the 19th century. Settle them on some land, discover mineral wealth on that land, drive the originals off the land, and steal the minerals. In Australia, instead of exposing the theft, the establishment media are aiding it by broadcasting the government's lies unchallenged. Pilger mentions John Howard. That's the former Prime Minister. And the television network ABC is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Back to John Pilger.
In 2006, the ABC's current affairs program, Late Line, broadcast lurid allegations of organized paedophile rings of sex slavery among the Mutitjulu people. The program's source, described as an anonymous youth worker, was later exposed as a federal government official, indeed an assistant secretary working in Mal Brough's Aboriginal Affairs Department in Canberra. Brough himself told Late Line, "Everybody knows who runs the paedophile rings." The latest media war on the Aboriginal people was well underway. Even though Brough withdrew his comment, even though the Northern Territory Chief Minister denied the Late Line allegations, and the police denied them too. But the symbiosis between media and government was such that John Howard was able to declare what he called a national emergency and send in the army and business managers into Aboriginal communities in the north. Did Howard really care about black children, whose basic rights he had steadfastly opposed since the day he came to office? Or was there another agenda? What was reported, hardly at all, was that the government was clawing back Aboriginal land rights in the only part of Australia where they exist comprehensively. The Northern Territory contains extraordinary mineral wealth, including huge deposits of uranium on Aboriginal land. Under Howard, the number of companies licensed to explore for uranium doubled to 80. At the same time, the government spent millions appropriating Aboriginal land for the dumping of toxic waste. The Northern Territory borders the Arafura and Timor Seas, and their oil and gas riches. Last month, a truth emerged quietly, unobtrusively. Of the 7,433 Aboriginal children examined as part of the so-called intervention, 39 have been referred to the authorities for suspected abuse. And of those 39 cases, a maximum 4 possible abuses were identified. Let me repeat that. 4 out of almost 7,500. There was no sex slavery, and the emergency was the same old poverty and despair and denial of resources for health, education, you name it. Lateline has neither retracted or apologized. Such are the rules of war by journalism. And under Kevin Rudd, the intervention continues. What's more, Rudd's Indigenous Affairs Minister, Jenny Mackey, now threatens to withdraw support from remote Aboriginal communities that are, she says, wait for it, economically unviable. What is it about the Aboriginal story that leaves so many Australians so bereft of decent behaviour and so eager to believe the old myths? To my knowledge, only two journalists, Deborah Jobson and Joel Gibson of the Sydney Morning Herald, have exposed the fact that hundreds of millions of dollars, which the federal government claims it spends on Indigenous affairs, have never been spent or have been used to benefit whites or have gone into actually opposing native title claims. Why do we allow such myths? What have we got to hide? Perhaps we know, deep down, as they say, that the paradise we promote all over the world still doesn't quite belong to us. A hero of mine is Edward Smith Hall. I would make his story obligatory in all media courses. In 1826, Hall launched his weekly 8-page, 8-penny newspaper, the Sydney Monitor. On the front page, in large type, was a definition of a journalist, and I quote, "an inveterate opposer rather than a staunch parasite of government," unquote. I like that. The colony of New South Wales was then effectively a British military dictatorship. Governor Darling, I think, was in charge. Hall was having none of it. He exposed corruption and malfeasance, and he demanded democracy on behalf of his readers. He refused to befriend any politician. He was often in jail pending trial for criminal defamation, which was then the favourite device for suppressing unpalatable truth. Perhaps more than anyone, this little-known journalist planted the seeds of three basic liberties in Australia: freedom of the press, representative government, and trial by jury. So what happened then? Well, another kind of journalism arrived with advertising. And the Edward Smith Halls were declared obsolete, or they were shunted into the margins as not really one of us. To attract big advertisers, the new corporate press formed close alliances with the establishment. In America, the first schools of journalism were set up with pretensions of respectability that matched their corporate endowments, and the myth of objective neutrality was spun around the so-called professional journalist. What the public didn't know was that in order to be professional, journalists were trained, perhaps groomed is a better word, to ensure that news and opinion was in effect validated and dominated by official sources. Take almost any major Australian newspaper today. Check the sources of the main political stories, domestic and foreign, and you'll find they're dominated by government and established interests. That's the essence of what's called impartial, objective journalism. Now, this is not to suggest, and I must emphasise this, that independent journalism is excluded. But it's the honourable exceptions. So what can be done? Well, first, we should begin, I think, to recognise the gatekeepers, those who guard the spaces of public debate and see off dissent. One of the sponsors of this festival is the liberal-minded magazine The Monthly. A recent issue devoted 10 pages to a character assassination of the Australian maverick journalist Wilfred Burchett. the reporter who was first to expose the horror of Hiroshima. What was extraordinary about this 10-page assault was that Burchard has been dead for 23 years. The article was an especially Australian blend of hearsay, smear, and omission. A key part of this type of work is the destruction of reputation, rather than a reasoned critique of issues that should concern us all. The author of the Burchard attack was Robert Mann. What struck me about his remarkable 10-page attack on Burchard was how vividly it demonstrated how the gatekeepers of the Australian elite have never really recovered from the Cold War virus that brain damaged so much of our political and cultural life and that still sets the boundaries of political debate in this country. Again, the question begs, what's to be done? Well, let's celebrate those who break the silence, the honourable exceptions. One of my favourites, the Chaser, whose imagination and courage shamed those who remained silent while Sydney was taken over by Howard and Bush and the police during the APEC conference last year. And let's ask some questions. Let's examine the Prime Minister's literary awards. These are meant to recognise, and I quote, the major contribution of Australian literature to the nation's cultural and intellectual life. No, they don't. Dangling a tax-free prize of $100,000, they serve to pacify our cultural and intellectual life. All the titles on the current shortlist of 15 are as safe as houses, including a book on Napoleon. Only four of the publishers are Australian, and none of the authors need the money. What a message to send out to young writers. Speaking as a journalist, I believe we need a public movement that monitors, deconstructs, and counters the corporate media. In every university, in every media college, in every newsroom, teachers of journalism and journalists themselves need to ask themselves about the part they play in the misinformation and disinformation that allows great power to have its bloody way. Such a counter-movement within the media could herald a perestroika of a kind we've not known, as the internet has already demonstrated. And the public would be part of it, learning how to decode the news and demand the truth. But we need to make haste. Liberal democracy is moving towards a form of corporate dictatorship. This is an historic shift, and the media and compliant and silent writers must not be allowed to be its facade. If those of us who are meant to keep the record straight and tell the truth and break silences fail to do this, then who will? That great whistleblower, Tom Paine, warned that if the majority of the people were denied the truth and the ideas of truth, it was time to storm what he called the Bastille of Words. That time is now. Thank you.
John Pilger speaking on power, propaganda, and the silence of writers. You can find a link to the video of the complete talk on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thanks for listening. Question authority. Speak the truth, if you can get away with it. Illegitimi non carborundum, and see you later.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today, December 27th, 2017, there are 2,963 architects and engineers who have signed a petition demanding a new investigation into the events of 9/11. And if you would like to join their ranks and send a larger and stronger message, the website to go to is ae911truth.org. The show you're about to hear today was originally aired in March of 2012, and I think it's well worth repeating. A replay of the first part was aired last week, and today you'll hear the second and final part, so let's begin. Today you'll hear the second and final part of a speech given by Dr. John McMurtry, author and professor of philosophy at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. This is a very powerful speech and was given at the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 on May 30th, 2004, in Toronto. I was actually at that conference, but somehow missed Dr. McMurtry's speech. Someone shared it with me recently from hearing it on Bonnie Faulkner's show Guns and Butter on KPFA out of Berkeley, California. She aired it in March of 2010. And you can also find it on globalresearch.ca, where it was also posted in March of 2010. What you'll hear today comes from the Guns and Butter show. The title of the speech is Why the Facts of 9/11 Are Suppressed, with a subtitle called Understanding the Ruling Group Mind Behind the War Without End. So let's get started. Here's Dr. John McMurtry.
U.S. investment interests and defense installations increasingly span the globe in the name of everybody else's liberation. 9/11 is the pivot on which it all turns. In the background, David Rockefeller advised the corporate elect of the beacon of solution long ago. A supranational sovereignty, and this is a quote from him, a supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers, unquote, he long ago explained at the June 1991 Bilderberg annual meeting, quote, is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries. National autodetermination is what's being eliminated. In the foreground, devout 9/11 story believers await the rapture to come. For all the magic of the invisible hand infallibly transfigures infinite self-desire into the best of all possible worlds. That's right into neoclassical economics now, and I'll soon be into that. The optimum means the best of all possible worlds. The 9/11 turn to war across the Middle East, Baghdad, and Central Asia is in this moral universe the intersection of divine plan and history, with God's modern chosen nation now fulfilling the grand mission to liberate peoples everywhere to the promised land of the global free market, with no public realm left anywhere unsubjugated to market disciplines and chief executive command. It's all modeled on the corporate hierarchy of command. The regulating group mind behind the 9/11 or the global market wars. At the core of the borderless meta program, which regulates the perception and understanding of our epoch, lies the ruling group mind. Its ancestor predates the U.S. as a nation, but corporate America and its president express its last global armed crusade. Not even the more ancient duty of the colonial state to build infrastructure instead of destroy it inhibits the pure corporate capitalist form of U.S. empire. Not even the life security of America's own citizens figures into the money sequence system into which all that exists is converted. From the water we drink to the genes of what we eat, from the countries of the non-market world to the sky over our heads. for the conversion of all life organization and their conditions into commodities and money demand and perpetual growth is known to be identical to our freedom. Thus, only more market money transactions for price commodities for a profit with no life coordinates anywhere involved count in our national accounts today, including Canada's national account, as development or well-being. This is the inner meaning of what is called, quote, the free world. The fatal problem was evident to Abraham Lincoln over a century ago, and this is not much quoted. Lincoln warned in a private letter, quote, as a result of the war, corporations have been enthroned by the war, as usual, and an era of corruption in high places will follow. And the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed. Unquote. That's Lincoln. Lincoln was assassinated within a few months, 5 months of that letter, to a colonel. U.S. corporate rule has since been instituted across the world, and now triumphalist over all alternatives invades across the world wherever there is room for, quote, more freedom and development for its money sequencing operations. Whether the civil common sectors and unpriced life spaces within existing capitalist societies or the entire economy and resource stocks of non-capitalist societies which are defenseless against attack. The inner logic of the corporate order's globalization is not dependent on this or that administration, and that's important to remember. It is a meta-program of regulating assumptions, and it has sedimented over centuries into the ruling mindset of our epoch. Its principles are now mathematically enshrined in neoclassical market models, but they are also the regulators of everyday thought across the world. As with the one true faith of a former age, the ruling principles are variously comprehended and normally function at the preconscious level. No one safely challenges, however, any of them. In order to understand the ruling market mind, since Adam Smith published its first testament in the year of the American Revolution, we need to understand its system-deciding principles which form the bare metaphysic of the 9/11 wars. This thing goes deep. Together, these principles set the logic of the ruling group mind and the meaning of its invisible hand tech theology out of which the 9/11 turning point and the new market wars have been fanatic expressions. The regulating structure of market perception and understanding is the determiner of social meaning to which official culture in both industrial and third world societies now tacitly conforms since the end of the opposing superpower in 1991. The fall of the Soviet state marked the decisive turning point in the ascension of the market group mind as having no alternative, the end of history. 9/11 marked a less understood turning point in this meta-program's global dominance by legitimating preemptive attack on any movement or force perceived to stand in the way of its freedom and self-defense. Whether unarmed, quote, violence-threatening protesters, unquote, in domestic public spaces or, quote, suspected terrorists, unquote, in civilian populations of the occupied world. Behind all the infinite variations of times and conditions of which postmodernism is the bacchanalian revel, one unexamined meta-program of perception and judgment has increasingly ruled as the system-deciding market group mind. Its inner logic determines every step of the global market crusade by the U.S. war state before and especially since 9/11, with the latter providing it its carte blanche. What before 9/11 was a world slowly coming under universal norms of life protection and understanding of the destructive life blindness of the global market system was, after 9/11, a monoculture of one enemy which was disconnected from every real problem humanity faces. That's the big disconnection. We need to keep in mind here that it was 1 month before 9/11 that the greatest international demonstration ever against the global market system occurred, with NATO warplanes flying overhead in Genoa and police beating masses of demonstrators while they slept on false pretexts of terrorism amongst them. 9/11 reversed the historical tide forming against the global corporate system, its most concealed function. The inner algorithm of command of the global market system itself was war drummed out of view. The bearer of this determining algorithm of the mega machine is the ruling market group mind, and it is regulated by the following set of principles to which all of official culture conforms without question, including our own. One, this is the bear type. Pursuit in a market order of maximal monetary assets and commodities for oneself is natural for humans, rational in all places and times, necessary for all social progress and development. Two, there is no rightful limit on acquisition of these market assets and all things, or any countervailing right to redistribution of their holdings, however unequal they become. Leo Strauss, the man behind the National Security Council for years in the U.S., the theoretician, says that limitless accumulation of private capital is the highest moral duty. Three, freedom to buy and sell and self-maximizing transactions of money and price commodities is the basis of all human liberty and justice, and there is no outer limit in its rightful globalization. Four, the market's money price system always optimally allocates resources and distributes goods and services in each and every society to ensure the best of all possible worlds. Five, I mean, this is all deducible for or axiomatized in neoclassical theory. Money profit maximization by investors is the ultimate engine of economic and social advance and is maximally liberated from the dead hand of state regulation and ownership. Six, government intervention, therefore, in the self-regulating market is wrong unless it supports the market system and dictatorial in proportion to replacement of free market flows of market commodities and capital. And this is why we can understand what's going on in Venezuela and Haiti before that. And so on. Seven, individual consumer desires are permanently increasing and unlimited in their growth by human nature and are what all free people want more to satisfy. Eight, the public interest in human welfare are only increased by a market economy which produces all that is good, including democracy, poverty alleviation, and human civilization. Market growth is therefore beneficial in all places and time, with no limit to the conversion of planetary and human life organization into more priced goods for consumers and profits for firms. Protection of domestic production of any type is the evil of protectionism, although subsidization of dominant enterprises may be necessary to the national interest. 11. Whatever facts of life disaster may seem to contradict the necessity and validity of market principles 1 through 10, the ones I've just read, they're always understood as corrected by better application and more rigorous application of market principles. 12. If the creative destruction, as it's called, of the global market destroys old environments and ways of life, these are unavoidable costs of technological progress to be solved by market means. 13. Individuals, groups, or governments which doubt or criticize, and here we get the war drum beginning, the supremacy of the market system or the inherent efficiency of its production and distribution or the freedom of its agents, thereby reject the free market and therefore democracy, and are therefore, it follows by transitivity, dangerous to humanity. 14. Any and all societies, parties, or governments which seek any lived alternative, and this is always what they attack, any lived alternative of economic organization, are to the extent of this irrational or evil and must be prevailed over by all means available, including armed force, and I would add 9/11, to protect and advance the free world for all. That's the meta program. A simple question tests the hold of these principles. What government, mass medium, or neoclassical economist does not conform to each and all of them? The Bush Jr. administration may be specially extreme in pushing the globalized free market by force of arms on false pretexts, but which of these principles is transgressed in speech or policy by even leaders of this administration's opponents? Who suggests that Iraq should be left free to pursue its own choice of a socialist path? More challengingly, we may ask, which was set up all along before Saddam, what market principle in any way rules out war criminal invasion of non-market societies? Or more challenging, we may ask, how would the allowance of 9/11, the engineering of 9/11 itself, violate any market principle? The answer is that it does not. The only cost recognized by the market value calculus is a cost to business. Lives are worth nothing. only market incomes are. In fact, no high-income executive, another strange fact Nuts investigated, seems to have been there on 9/11, and the costs were borne by the public. As for the U.S. market itself, it was already in a deep slide before 9/11 stimulated massive new government spending. The market recession was, of course, blamed on the terrorist attack. But that is an operation of the market group mind. Any facts which do not fit its assumptions are preconsciously inverted and reversed so that they do. More revealingly, the market meta program favors 9/11 by favoring its consequences. Destruction of a socialist state or an Islamic society for replacement by a free market is the maximum good possible for it. If we see through this moral prism, the set points of market understanding, only necessary and beneficent effects appear through the lenses of perception. Who could disagree with overthrow of an alien state dictatorship? Two of them, sitting near or on the global market's most precious and increasingly needed wealth. The magic thinking of market logic then cascades into optimal states of expectation afterwards. Extension of more efficient market relations of production and distribution to the locked-in resources and people involved. New private capital formations and freedoms. Opportunities for spectacular market growth where before there was none. Relief of consumers from inefficient Arab monopoly of oil. A competitive price system to properly deploy and allocate resources instead of an Islamic or socialist prison keeping the people in backward dependency on handouts and subsidies. And historic new vistas for foreign capital and local entrepreneurs to lead undeveloped Afghanistani and Iraqi societies out of the dark ages to the summum bonum of the era, the first Islamic market miracle. Certainly such market magic thinking and blindness to life facts has been abundantly evidenced already from the planning of the invasion on. Complete absence of any post-invasion plan to rebuild the economy shattered by two saturation bombings and 12 years of U.S. enforced sanctions. To restore the destroyed life infrastructure that had killed over 500,000 children, or indeed to do anything but let an imagined liberation and market miracle spontaneously recreate a society from the genocide of the society, the socialist society, over 12 years. This revealed a derangement of mind disconnected from the life world, but no one has yet followed it back to its source. The complete incapacity of the market state invaders to plan for or provide even public security of the most basic infrastructures of water and electricity, let alone food and employment or health care or education or freedom from attack, and most of which Iraq had led the region in development prior to the first invasion, the key ignored fact, revealed a superstitious structure of market logic at work. Could any mumming of slogans and systematic destruction of life systems from the dark ages rival this continuously barbaric outcome? Yet what market principle selects against any step? The deepened prejudice of the market calculus that it is life-blind in principle and can only compute money sequences and sums. The same set point of perception and value judgment reaches back to 9/11 and before. The unspeakable truth is that no market principle is not better realized through the 9/11 attack, and that's why people keep saying it's better. Okay, it has to be better. If 9/11 had not been planned by the ex-ally bin Laden and enacted by the, quote, moral equivalents of the founding fathers, unquote, as Reagan called the Taliban and their allies, in the U.S. finance war against another secular socialist government, what else could have justified the new global market wars? Market logic is the hidden system decider throughout. One more level of the metaprogram of the mind, however, is required to propel and legitimate its supreme crimes against humanity as acts of self-defense and liberation. That is the religion of America. And it expresses the global market program as a war crusade across the world with America as the messiah state. This layer of the ruling group mind is what directly regulates the hearts and minds of America. It's their daily frame of reference and fixed pole star. This mind can only feel and see inside its own closed circle. U.S., our own group, in the master phrase of the philosopher King Leo Strauss. The ruling group locates the group mind it shares with the people by polls of opinion and arrives at the narcissist center for everything in the religion of America, America itself. What is of everywhere else angry at lawless U.S.-led destruction of planetary life organization is reversed now into a hatred of America, the new correlative of anti-Semitism. Here or there, the narcissist self-center can only go one place, back to itself as good, and others as jealous or evil. Clinically, psychiatry knows the disorder as a propensity to auto-suggestive hysteria and disconnection from reality, apt descriptors. When psychopathic, diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders suggests, the self-center lies glibly, manipulates others, is parasitic, and denies all responsibility for destructive actions. The clinical definitions and the reality meet, but do not give us the regulating frame of mind through which it sees and comprehends the syntax of meaning in terms of which it knows itself as free and good. The group mind of America, the second coming by force of arms. The moral syntax of the American group mind is the wheel within the wheel of the global market religion. All its principles are presupposed as the way that God is presupposed by the religious fundamentalists. An all-powerful, all-knowing, and jealous ruler of the world rightfully determines the course of reality, and none may doubt it. We may know of the pre-Reformation Islam that is the primitive counterpart, but we do not know the beast itself. We sense it in U.S. witch hunts and vast prisons of the poor, doing no offense to any person. 86% are there for no harm to the person. But we do not see the creed's fanatical mode in the global market's expansion led by the U.S. in the war crusade that has no end and understands itself as freedom. The God of America is primitive. It worships itself. But there are a set of silently regulating principles at work through all the phenomena of its rule, which together constitute the ruling group mind, which has imprisoned global culture within its premises since 9/11. And I'm only going to give one, but it's the key one. The ultimately regulating premise of this ruling group mind is that the U.S. national security state is America. This assertion is never directly stated because that would reveal the absurdity of the equation. But the assumption nevertheless regulates every statement on Americans' relations with the rest of the world, which have been proclaimed from the U.S. government since 9/11. It, in turn, is rooted in a deep cultural chorality which it expresses in Leviathan form. The state does. And the deep cultural form is, I can kill, therefore I am. This is a logic that goes back to before Hegel's master-slave dialectic first glorified its threat as the source of philosophy. There is almost no popular form of American culture that does not bear its undertow meaning. From hunting, WrestleMania, and video games to the language of sports and dramatic content of television and movie entertainments. We won't explore this meaning here, but we'll consider only the institutionalized form of it on the world stage. The equation of meaning between the U.S. Armed Forces Command and war and intelligence apparatus, and America itself as a country, and increasingly Canada. This preconscious equation explains, for example, why even the U.S. government's official opposition, the Democratic Party, abdicated from political responsibility in its fear of appearing to oppose unjustified wars against essentially defenseless third world societies. They too are all incarcerated within the ruling structure of mind, more paralyzed than 1930 Germans in their dread of being named unpatriotic. This is a fear which can only be explained by the equation of the state military command and its apparatus with America. Beneath the surface phenomena of party politics and competing media and opinions, the great diversity, rules one group mind. The equation of America to its armed state apparatus is never publicly challenged in the official culture of the free world because the equation is assumed a priori. No one who houses the false equation can tell them apart. They cannot see, therefore, the demonstrable falsehoods of the war state, the overthrow of the Republic's democratic traditions, and least of all the safety of millions of innocent civilians in other countries, not to say the 2,600 deaths of U.S. citizens, because they assume America and its national security apparatus are one and the same. Since they love America and America is it and we love America as our neighbor, none of us can distinguish between our beloved country and the criminal gang institutions of the National Security Council, the Pentagon, and the CIA. As these rogue secret societies, especially the U.S. intelligence, defense intelligence, as these rogue secret societies rule on behalf of U.S. investments across the world by the force of armed terror, mass disinformation, secret narco links, and political bribery and coercion at every level, lovers of America are obliged to defend this monstrous construction as America. This equation and the president as the president. This equation obliges them to be blind to fact. It then misleads them into supposing that anyone who opposes a gangster state rule of the world is anti-American. One absurd equation develops and builds on another and ends as a paranoid mass cult characterized as patriotism. Just as in the 1930s with the world's most powerful industrial state. It is this false equation at the baseline of the group mind that we find the kernel of our world's problem. America's self-definition is capacity to kill others, unbound by international law. 9/11 is both the karmic blowback and the launching site of this self-equation in the global market war for empire without end. Thank you.
You've just been listening to the second and final part of a speech given by Professor of Philosophy, Dr. John McMurtry, of the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. That speech was given in 2004. A recent article posted on Russia Today on November 8, 2013, with the title, 2013, Deadliest Year Since 2008, with 7,000 plus killed. And I'm just going to read you a short piece from the article. It says, the American author of Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq, Nicholas J.S. Davies, believes the U.S.-led operation had simply devastated the nation. The invasion was not just some kind of mistake. The invasion and occupation were a serious crime. Davies told RT, quote, that was a crime of aggression under the UN Charter. Iraq is still suffering from the destruction of its regime, its government, society, by the U.S. The U.S. employed classic divide-and-rule strategy, pitting people of different sects against each other, inciting violence that is completely unprecedented in that country, and now has instilled a sectarian-based government. And this is just a reign of terror. And in that sense, some of the worst aspects of the U.S. occupation are still continuing today. In December already, there were 314 civilian deaths and a total for the year so far of 8,500. And although most of the troops are out of Iraq, there are still mercenaries there, U.S. Special Forces, the CIA, all still remain there. And the facts are available to show that what we've been told about 9/11 is also a lie. If you want to learn about these scientific facts, go to the website ae911truth.org or rethink911.org or get yourself a copy of one of David Ray Griffin's books about 9/11 or go to the website 911truth.org or ct911truth.org and they all have links to other websites and books. The consequences of 9/11 have been and continue to be devastating to the U.S., to the entire world. The only ones who have benefited are the already powerful and wealthy, who have just gotten more powerful and wealthier. We, on the other hand, have lost our civil liberties, our privacy, our democracy, and our money, and have been given a surveillance state that tortures, detains people indefinitely without due process. And now we even have a president that can target and kill U.S. citizens in drone attacks on the suspicion that they might be involved in terrorism. So please make an effort to learn the facts of 9/11 if you haven't already done so. You may be really surprised at what you learn. And now here's some information about my shows. 9/11 Wake Up Call can be heard on WWUH 91.3 FM on Wednesdays at 12 noon and at 8 p.m. Also, some of the older shows are archived at the website ct911truth.org, and you can catch the more recent ones by Googling Radio for All. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. Power!
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. An escalating legal battle played out in the case of Ravi Ragbir, executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition, an immigrant rights activist whose detention on Thursday by federal immigration authorities sparked protests that led to the arrest of 18 people, including members of the New York City Council. Ravi Ragbir, the executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York City, had shown up for a check-in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Thursday morning at the Jacob Javits Federal Building in Lower Manhattan and was then detained. Here to speak with us about the case of Ravi Ragbir is Amy Gottlieb, the Associate Regional Director for the Northeast Region of the American Friends Service Committee, who in this role is responsible for supporting programs in the Northeast region that focus on immigrant rights, and she is the wife of Ravi Ragbir.
Thanks so much, Mimi.
You know, exactly at this time last week, we were speaking with Reverend Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of the New Sanctuary Coalition, about the case of Jean Montrevelle, a co-founder of the New Sanctuary Coalition also, who was detained by ICE and sent to the Chrome Detention Center in Florida. And we were encouraging our listeners to show up for the Jericho Walk to encircle the federal building and walk in visual and spiritual and actual support of our brother and sister immigrants called to check in with ICE and who, like Ravi, many might not have been able to check out. So there's a terrible, painful irony in doing the program today, but let's begin in earnest by giving us the status right now of your husband, our executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition and one of the leading activists in the immigrants' rights movement in the country. What's happening right now?
Yeah. Thanks for asking, Mimi. Right now, Ravi is detained in Miami at the Chrome Detention Center. He was brought there on Thursday afternoon, very quickly after he had been brought to a hospital. He had actually fainted during the ICE check-in when they told him that they were going to be, quote, enforcing removal and putting him in custody. So they were required to take him to a hospital, and right directly from the hospital, unbeknownst to us, we had no idea, he was taken to Newark Airport and flown to Chrome, where he continues to be. There was a hearing yesterday. We are asking, at a minimum, that he be brought up back to the New York area so that he can be close to family, to his legal counsel, to his community. And, of course, that, you know, our ultimate desire is that he be released. But at a minimum, we want him brought closer to here. So we had a hearing yesterday in federal court. We do not have a decision from that case. We hope to have that in the next day or two, hopefully today. And we're hoping to have a decision that says that that ICE has to bring him back to his community.
And then, as we mentioned earlier, there is Gene as well. And what I'm wondering is your thoughts about whether or not there is also a targeting of activists in the immigrants' rights sphere and members of the New Sanctuary Coalition.
Yeah, at this point, maybe I don't think there can be a doubt that there is a connection and that there's targeting and retaliation against people who have been willing to dissent, who've been willing to say that ICE practices are unconscionable and unfair. We have Ravi, we have Gene, we have Maru in Seattle, who is being placed into deportation proceedings right now, a very outspoken activist who's done a lot of work on detention issues out there. So there's no coincidence that in the span of a week or a week and a half, we're seeing three leaders being specifically targeted by ICE. And it's extraordinarily troubling. And the manner in which they're doing it is, it's despicable, honestly, you know, snatching people away from their families.
And, of course, we've seen throughout the country and certainly in New York, many on Long Island, 7-Elevens that have mm-hmm. been raided. And I remember when I was a kid, really, in Junior's restaurant in Brooklyn and a big restaurant in Sheepshead Bay called Lundy's, when there actually used to be ICE raids in the kitchens there. And mm-hmm. you would see people scattering for their very lives as ICE was rounding up people in the most punitive manner and just literally snatching them. I've always thought of them as a kind of body snatchers. And I want mm-hmm. You to talk a little bit about, obviously that's happening again, but the whole question of unjust detention.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have this network of, you know, a couple hundred facilities throughout the country that are a combination of privately run, federally run, and county jails that contract with the federal government that are holding immigrants, right? We have probably about 40,000 immigrants per day who are locked up solely on immigration violations. So where Ravi is at Chrome, it's overcrowded. The first 3 or 4 days that he was there, he didn't have a bed. He had a cot. We just keep packing people into the system. We're paying a ton of money for it, and, you know, ranging from around $90 to $150 per bed per day, per person per day to the federal government. And then private prisons, of course, are making money off of this, or private contractors that, if the prison itself is not private, the contracting services inside, the phone company, the commissary, the medical, those are all the guards often are contracted out. So, you know, there are private companies that are making money off of this as families are torn apart. And it was telling for me when I went down, I went to Chrome to visit Ravi over the weekend. And, you know, people are held so far. We don't know, of course, who all the people in Chrome are. A lot of them are recent arrivals from Central America. But on a Sunday morning at 9:30, when I had my appointment to go in and have a family visit through plexiglass, I was one of only about five people who were there visiting their loved ones. And that really struck me that, you know, somehow these people are so isolated that people either are not able to get to visit them or they don't have contacts in this community. And so we have this web of systems where, you know, we're tearing people apart from the world that they've lived in. And, you know, for those who are recent arrivals, many of them are fleeing violence, severe violence, have been victims of trauma, sexual assault, and, you know, have their freedom taken away, their jails.
I remember so well some years back, Amy, when I was listening to you make a presentation, and one of your very, very forceful arguments where you described the issue of people being referred to as illegal. and how it divides communities and, of course, dehumanizes immigrants. And it also has the other effect when you describe the issue of immigration as one of legality, of militarization of the borders and so on. I wonder if you can talk more about that whole perspective, just to really give a sense of the fact that there is a war on migrants. There is a war on refugees. There is a war on immigrants who, of course, were, along with slave labor, the backbone, and along with indigenous people, are what constitute the working class of this country.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember that exact presentation that I gave, but that is something I've talked about for many years. And, but it, you know, it's funny because it's tragic and sad, but at this point, you know, that feels so far away. We have been, I think, scrambling to keep up with our narrative because we're facing so much demonization, dehumanization, militarization. I mean, what has exploded over the last 2 years, I would say, and I attribute a lot of this to, you know, some of the presidential campaign language, that, you know, we've sort of gotten to a place where we have to defend against, you know, people who are calling other countries holes, or who are, you know, calling people from Mexico rapists, or, you know, what have you, that we're in this position of having to defend that, so that the conversation about illegal has gotten a little bit buried. And I think it's a really important one, and I'm glad you're raising it, because, you know, we do have this system where we have set up this divide. We've created a system where nobody is willing to sort of look at the deeper roots of migration, why people are migrating, what are the conditions that cause people to make a decision to leave their families, as if that's something, you know, simple to do. You know, what are, and also, what are the conditions that allow us to reach a point where our government officials, and I include many of our government officials in that, are forced to put up a wall and dehumanize themselves in order to take these actions against immigrant communities, so that there's dehumanization on all sides. You know, and the militarization that we talk about is just, it's rampant. It's everywhere. It's, you know, when Ravi was, taken to the hospital and then taken to the airport, he was accompanied, when he was in the hospital, I think he said there were 8 ICE agents with him, 8 ICE agents with somebody seeking medical treatment who had fainted during an ICE interview. And we had NYPD there also. So, you know, there's really big questions about how we're targeting people and what we are sort of becoming as a nation when the violence has become the norm, right? State violence has become the norm. And I feel very, very, very strongly that what happened to Ravi and what happened to me last Thursday with the treatment that we received, those were violent, violent acts imposed upon us by our federal government.
And of course, one of the reasons that Ravi was so successful and respected so much as the executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition was because he also has firsthand knowledge of the deportation system, because he was facing removal. He's been fighting it to remain here with his family, his friends, his supporters, his wife, yourself. And I want you to talk a little bit within that about the whole question of the unjust detention and the process, which is rife with problematic as well, which very few people have a chance to focus on and understand.
Well, you know, Ravi is a person who's gone through this now. I mean, it's been 15 years since he was originally convicted of a wire fraud crime, more than that, 18 years since he was convicted of a crime. He's been fighting his deportation since 2006. It's a hard case. But as we go through this, you know, when we were told on Thursday last week that he was being taken into custody, it's like your entire world gets cut off from you. You know, he made a clear decision to be public about what he was facing. And that was, we knew that was a risk. He also made a clear decision not to hide from this, not to, you know, go into sanctuary and not to say that's not the right thing for certain people. But for Robbie, that wasn't the right thing. He really wanted to see where this played out in a public way and turn himself in and hope that, you know, ICE would do the right thing. So we went in last Thursday not really expecting that he'd be taken in based on some conversations that had happened previously. And when we were sitting there and they said they were going to take him in, it was like our entire world turned upside down, right? I mean, honestly, you know, he was not given any chance to, you know, even take care of basic things in his life that might have needed to be taken care of. Because you're just literally taken away. And then to be, you know, to make it so much worse, they take him 1,000 miles away where his lawyers are not accessible. I'm not accessible. Other family members and friends are not accessible. So, you know, this idea that locking people up, you know, jailing this, you know, sort of major contributor to the additional expansion of mass incarceration is it's what our government is relying on, and it's where we need to put our efforts to fight back, because it is, you know, it's devastating on so many levels to so many people. And, you know, as my dad was saying to Robbie the other day, you know, this is not something that just impacts Amy and Robbie. This is something that has way deeper impact across our family, across our community, across activism, across people who are wanting to, you know, come out and be open about their stories. And the government is using detention as a major weapon.
And, of course, there's no accountability. You've expressed the brutalization as part of the process, the unjust detention, the targeting of activists, and the issue of accountability, which seems not to exist in any meaningful way. And I know that you have a hard time to leave us with other appointments. So I want you to talk a little bit about accountability, and then most significantly, what we can do as we stand up. That's what our audiences do when they listen to people like yourself. What do we do to support Ravi Ragbir, Executive Director of the New Sanctuary Coalition, and make sure that he stays with his families, his friends, his community, and continues to do the enormously important work of supporting immigrants' rights, which is absolutely essential at this particular point in history?
I agree with that. In terms of accountability, you know, unfortunately, a lot of what ICE is doing is within the law, right? I mean, they have discretion to not detain at times. They have discretion to not deport. They have discretion to issue stays of removal, but they're not doing it. They were doing it, and they're not doing it anymore. So I think there are opportunities for us to really be witnessing, paying attention, participate in accompaniment, so that we all know what's going on and we can push our legislators to make fundamental changes in the law so that ICE does not have this untethered authority to just keep locking people up and deporting people without accountability. So I think, you know, as much as you can pay attention, be involved, New Sanctuary has, you know, opportunities to support immigrants who are going into check-ins, who are going into immigration court. Pay attention, understand the system, visit people in detention, write to people in detention. New Sanctuary is continuing its efforts to raise awareness of this through Jericho walks and rallies and vigils. There's another one tomorrow at 11 a.m. in front of Federal Plaza, and then another vigil tomorrow evening at 5 p.m. at Varick Street Detention Center on Varick and Houston. So there are opportunities to be present in this and to show up and to share that, you know, get this information out there, bring folks out. I mean, we've seen such a surge of support when Robbie was taken in on Thursday. I mean, you know, what happened in the streets was just, I think, the beginning or a new beginning of increased movement towards, you know, we're going to change this system.
And just lastly, tell us again where we're going to be tomorrow at one or both of those times.
Tomorrow in front of 26 Federal Plaza at 11 a.m., meet at Foley Square, and 5 p.m. at the corner of Varick and Houston Street in front of 201 Varick Street
and
5.
Amy, are there any letters to be sent in particular support of Robbie Ragbeer?
Yeah, there. You can go to the website. It's www.robbiedefense.wordpress.com, and there's a lot of information about how you can contact legislators, who you can write to, ICE officers. There's postcards you can download and share on social media. There's plenty of things that you can be doing right now, and we're very grateful for it.
Well, we're going to let you go. We're going to continue to pay close attention to this. Certainly, we will be at the Varick Street Center, Detention Center tomorrow, and at Federal Plaza. Amy, we wish you and your family well, and our dear brother, Ravi Ragbeer, picked up by ICE, must come home to his community, must come home to his family, and continue to do the excellent work that the New Sanctuary Coalition has been doing, and all of us have to get on board with this. It is the critical civil rights issue of our time right now. And we have been speaking with Amy Gottlieb, the Associate Regional Director of the Northeast Region of the American Friends Service Committee, and wife of Ravi Ragbeer, our dear brother, who we want home now. Amy, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Mimi.
You can have all the money in your hands, all the possessions anyone can ever have, but it's all worthless treasure. True worth is only measured not by what you got, but what you got in your heart. You can have everything, but what does it need? It all means who's looking back at you. Define the life you're living, not by what you take, but what you're giving. And if you bet on love, there's no way you'll ever lose. Take a stand, make a stand for what's right. It's always worth, always worth the fight. It all means nothing, and if you don't stand up.
Absolutely, stand up for something. Audra Day and Common, after that poignant piece with Amy Gottlieb about Ravi Ragbeer. Stand up for something.
Dozens of supporters leaning on a federal detention center's wall Thursday night in Soho, where immigration agents are believed to be holding well-known community immigration advocate Ravi Ragbeer.
They are retaliating against people who dare to say that this is a bad system, and Ravi dared to say that this is a bad system.
This was Ragbeer's worst fear, that a 17-year-old nonviolent federal wire fraud conviction, for which he already served 5 years in a detention center and prison, would one day lead to his deportation back to his native Trinidad, where he hasn't lived in 30 years.
What are your thoughts on this upcoming meeting?
We are absolutely terrified.
This is what Ragbir told us last year during our first interview, in which he did not want to be identified, conducted just weeks after President Trump's inauguration. Weeks later, Ragbir came face to face with the administration's more aggressive enforcement of federal immigration policy and was told to start gathering his travel documents.
My spirit feels heavy, heavy, very heavy right now.
Fast forward to Thursday morning's routine ICE check-in, and Ragbir was detained. He fainted upon hearing the news. A rally outside quickly turned into a full-blown protest in which 18 people were arrested, including New York City Councilman Yadanis Rodriguez and Jamani Williams.
Our orange man in the White House claims that he's getting rid of violent murderers and rapists and things of that nature, but he's not. He's getting rid of the Robbie Ragbirs of the world, or making our city better.
Federal immigration officials weighed in on Ragbir's case, releasing a statement which reads in part, quote, in an exercise of discretion, the agency had previously allowed him to remain free from custody with periodic check-ins while his case was under court review. He has since exhausted his petitions and appeals through the immigration courts, the Board of Immigration Appeals, and the U.S. District Court. He will remain in custody pending removal to Trinidad.
We spoke with Ragbir's attorney, and she says that contrary to the statement from ICE, that her client still does have legal options which have not been decided. Yet she still concedes that it has always been the case, and it still could be, that Ragbir's presence and ability to continue living in the United States will depend on the government's discretion.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
You know that we're now legally wives, spouses. I mean, how good is that?
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is.
A few months ago, we didn't know he'd ever get to being legally married in Australia. So the fact that today he'll have a husband is pretty incredible.
Oh, please don't cry.
Together we fought for this. And darling man, we won.
Yeah. Woo!
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. An inter-American court ruling requires regional rights for same-gender couples, a joy jock honors his lesbian mums, and marriage equality dawns down under. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending January 13th, 2018. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights, based in San Jose, Costa Rica, has ordered that country to let same-gender couples marry. The court's January 9th edict, in response to a request for a ruling by that country, is binding legal precedent for every other country that has ratified the American Convention on Human Rights. Those member states include Barbados, Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Mexico, Nicaragua, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, and the Dominican Republic. Private consensual adult same-gender sex is still against the law in a few of those countries. Others offer less than equal civil unions to same-gender couples. But the court said that separate laws for same-gender couples are not acceptable. The nations that have ratified the American Convention on Human Rights were ordered to guarantee access to all existing forms of domestic legal systems, including the right to marriage, in order to ensure the protection of all the rights of families formed by same-sex couples without discrimination. The court also ordered the Costa Rican government to allow trans people to legally change their name and gender on government documents.
The United States and Canada, although part of the Organization of American States, over which the Inter-American Court of Human Rights has jurisdiction, have not ratified the American Convention on Human Rights, but marriage equality already exists in those two countries. Costa Rican government officials applauded the ruling and said they would begin immediately drafting legislation to open marriage to same-gender couples. There's been no public response as yet from any of the other countries affected by the ruling. The court acknowledged that some nations would face institutional difficulties in opening civil marriage to same-gender couples, noting that opposition in heavily Roman Catholic Latin America is often based on religious belief. But the court ruled, in democratic societies, there should exist mutually peaceful coexistence between the secular and the religious.
One of the advocates general of the European Court of Justice, in an opinion published on January 11th, said that the marriages of gay and lesbian couples legally performed elsewhere should be recognized by every EU member state, even if that member state itself does not offer marriage equality. The decision came in the case of Romanian gay man Adrian Comen, who legally married his American partner, Clay Hamilton, in Brussels in 2010. Comen took his homeland to court after Romanian officials refused to grant spousal residency to Hamilton. Romania is among the few remaining EU countries that refuse to legally recognize same-gender couples in any form, a list that also includes Bulgaria, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Slovakia. 13 countries in the European Union have marriage equality, while 9 others have some form of civil partnerships. Under the EU's 2004 Freedom of Movement Principle, member states are required to grant residency to citizens' spouses from non-EU countries. The term spouse had previously been undefined. Advocate General Melchior Wathelet said this week that the term spouse includes gay and lesbian partners. While their decisions are not binding, judges on the European Court of Justice usually follow the recommendations of their advocates general. Since the Romanian Constitutional Court referred the case to the European Court of Justice in 2016, a U.S. evangelical-inspired movement has arisen in the country to constitutionally ban marriage equality.
You are both legally married!
Marriage equality officially arrived in Australia on January 9th. A few same-gender couples were allowed to marry earlier than that due to health or financial concerns. But hundreds of lesbian and gay couples across the country tied the knot, several just a few minutes after midnight, after the required 30-day waiting period following their declared intention to wed. Those declarations followed the final passage in Parliament of a marriage equality bill in early December. We'll have a lot more from our Down Under correspondent, Barry McKay, later on most of these This Way Out stations.
A 3-judge panel of India's Supreme Court, including the Chief Justice, announced on January 8th that the full bench would be reviewing the constitutionality of Penal Code Section 377, a British colonial-era law that outlaws sexual acts against the order of nature. The law even criminalizes consensual oral sex between a man and a woman and declares that only penile vaginal sex is natural. India's Supreme Court overruled a lower court decision in 2013 that had struck down the statute, saying at that time that only legislators could change the country's laws. Efforts in Parliament to do that have failed. But a Supreme Court ruling in a separate case in August last year declared that privacy is a fundamental right, and the decision even cited Section 377 as an example of the possible infringement of those rights. In response this week to a legal challenge filed by 5 well-known queer petitioners who say they're living in fear of being jailed because of Section 377, the Chief Justice noted that what is natural to one may not be natural to others. The court demanded a timely response to the petition from the government.
The U.S. Supreme Court this week refused to review a draconian license to discriminate law in the state of Mississippi. HB 1523 allows businesses and individuals, even government workers, to refuse service to LGBT people or anyone else they don't like, such as interracial heterosexual couples, based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. The law, which took effect in October, also overturned local anti-bias ordinances. HB 1523 declares, despite the U.S. Supreme Court marriage equality ruling, that only one man and one woman can marry, that sexual relations are confined to such a marriage, and that gender is determined at birth and cannot be changed. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit ruled late last year that those who brought suit did not have legal standing to challenge the law because they had not yet actually been harmed by it. The Supreme Court rejected the case without comment, but did not rule on its merits. The High Court justices are currently considering another religious discrimination case involving a Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple based on his devout Christian beliefs.
A Wisconsin school district settled out of court this week with trans student Ash Whitaker, who was denied access to the bathroom facilities at his high school that match his gender identity. The Kenosha Unified School District appealed a ruling in Whitaker's favor by the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in August to the Supreme Court. Under the settlement agreement, it will withdraw that appeal and pay $800,000 to compensate Whitaker for the harm caused by the policy and to cover his legal costs. The school board approved the settlement this week, but their attorneys claim that it was based on projected costs of continuing the appeal and not on the validity of their position. While the out-of-court settlement applies only to Whitaker, one of his attorneys said in a media statement that it sends the clear message to all school districts that discriminating against transgender students is against the law and harms students who simply want to go to school. Whitaker is currently a freshman at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and says he plans to major in biomedical engineering. "I am deeply relieved that this long, traumatic part of my life is finally over," he said in a press release, "and I can focus on my future and simply being a college student."
And finally, queer ally and pop diva Cher has confirmed that she'll be the headline performer at this year's Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras after party on March 3rd. She hinted about that possibility in a tweet late last month to her 3.5 million followers. Tickets sold out almost immediately. Organizers said that more space has been made available for the show and that a limited number of additional tickets, going for as much as $250, would be made available, though they'll probably all be gone by the time you hear this report. The Grammy, Emmy, Golden Globe, and Academy Award-winning performer has sold more than 100 million records worldwide and last toured Australia in 2005. Kylie Minogue, George Michael, and Cyndi Lauper have headlined Mardi Gras in the past. Sydney will host 17 days of performances, exhibitions, parties, and community events, capped off by the parade and after-party as part of the world-renowned LGBT festival that begins on February 16th. Mardi Gras creative director Greg Clark told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that Cher would be a fitting star to headline the 40th anniversary of one of the globe's premier queer events. "We have been trying to get Cher to Mardi Gras for so many years," he said. "They tried about 5 years ago and couldn't pull it off. But we've done it this year."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending January 13th, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
Felicity, do you promise not to load the dishwasher the wrong way or make Jenny always choose the restaurant?
I do.
We'll throw some rice with This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay in Sydney in a few moments. But first, let's hear from one beneficiary of Australia's newly won marriage equality who wasn't campaigning to tie the knot himself. Melbourne's all-queer, all-the-time radio station, Joy 94.9, produced a series of stories from the LGBTI community across Australia for the Community Radio Network during the postal plebiscite campaign late last year. One of those Yes for Love stories came from Ben Hall, host of Joy 94.9's More Music Mondays.
It's almost impossible to escape the emotions being felt by this debate we are in. And I wanted to share a personal story about my life. And I also wanted to make it from the perspective of kids that might have gay parents. Firstly, my parents both listen every week. So, hey, guys, love you guys so much. I know you're listening. But also, what makes my parents so special is that I have two mums, and I suppose what is now commonly called a rainbow family. Now, this is something that has come to be more widely accepted in our social circles today, but as a kid growing up in the 90s, it was considered much more taboo. And the greatest thing about being a kid is you don't really see bad in anyone unless it's forced on you or told otherwise. And for me, all I just saw was two loving parents that I obviously cared for so much. Just like other kids have a mum or a dad, I had two mums, and that was all I really knew. A hard part about growing up when I was younger was that I sometimes felt embarrassed to tell some of my other friends that I had two mums, and this wasn't, of course, because I hated my parents, but because I knew their relationship wasn't publicly accepted. Looking back now as well, I think I became numb to the stigma around my supposed different family. It didn't affect me emotionally, but I can look back now on it and see how times have really changed. But to think a kid should have to feel ashamed of who their parents are just because of the way they choose to live their own lives is kind of horrible. And sometimes the parents of some of my friends wouldn't let me play with their kids outside of school because they knew my parents were lesbians, and I didn't really understand what all that really meant, but I just think that's so wrong for a kid to be made to feel that way. And it's also a complete reverse on what I think we should be teaching our kids, which is love and acceptance. I can even remember a childhood friend, one of my best friends. He had an older brother that used to tease me in school, and he never said anything about my parents being gay, but I knew his mother wasn't accepting of my parents' relationship, and that was probably why he used to give me crap in school. This is also why I probably never openly told people about my parents back then. I don't want to really rant on for too much longer, but I just want to say that I hope no kid today should have to feel that just because their parents are gay that they are any different to any other families, because they're not, in my opinion. And I also have to say it was so beautiful to see little kids at the marriage equality rally yesterday proudly standing with their parents and shouting for their deserved place in society. I think it's obvious now that a lot has changed since my upbringing over 20 years ago, but also based on what we are hearing from opposing arguments in this debate, it's clear we still need to keep fighting. And I really hope Australia can rise above its own prejudices, if there's anyone out there feeling that way, or personal beliefs, to vote for something that is the right for others. And I also hope that we can live in a world where kids can feel encouraged and motivated to know the world supports their parents, no matter what their sexual orientation might be. No person or parent in any case may be perfect, but my parents always encouraged me to be whatever I wanted to be and to, best of all, love myself.
Yes for Love is a presentation by Joy for the Community Radio Network.
Our thanks to them and Ben Hall.
I'm Edmund White. It is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful over the past couple of decades. And one radio program has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out on this station.
On the first day of Marriage Equality Down Under, the mainstream media air was all abuzz. Our Barry McKay concludes his series of Australian Marriage Chronicles reports with a look at some of that coverage.
The 9th of January was the first date that same-sex couples could legally wed in Australia without any special exemptions for the one-month waiting period needed when a couple formally gives notice to the authorities of their intention to tie the knot. Many couples did not waste any time in getting married and had a midnight wedding as the clock ticked over to the 9th of January, as this report from SBS News Australia illustrates.
3, 2, 1.
At the stroke of midnight, eager wedding guests gathered to celebrate love.
I pledge to be sensitive and respectful.
Diana and Deanne Ribeiro made a lifelong commitment to each other 5 years ago. This time, the ceremony was legally binding.
It's more about having equal rights. You know, for me, Deanne's always been my wife, always been my love of my life.
A rainy Sydney morning wasn't going to hold couples back. Kylie and Lisa were best friends before they became partners in 2014. Their daughter turns one on Sunday.
We want her to know that we're raising her in a progressive country. You know, that's really important to us, not just for same-sex marriage, but that we open our hearts and our minds to all sorts of, changes.
Changes to the Marriage Act passed Parliament in December after a heated public discussion and postal survey saw almost 62% of Australians vote yes. Celebrants have already seen a boost in business.
Now that they're all going to be able to be legal, then it's really exciting as a celebrant.
A report from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation also went with the midnight marriage theme with a sporty twist.
making history just minutes after midnight. Athletes Craig Burns and Luke Sullivan raced to make sure they were among the first to tie the knot.
Equality in this way, where we can get married, is a huge step forward for Australia. And you have to take your wins where you can get them.
The couple planned the ceremony backwards, choosing to have their photos and their reception first, and then waiting for the early hours of January 9th to tie the knot. Of course, January 9th is the first day in Australia where same-sex couples can legally tie the knot. Luke says he's been bombarded on social media with messages of support.
My Instagram direct messages have blown up with people who I've never met, I don't know, who are just sending love and congratulations. So it's really touching and it's really heartfelt.
Craig says he felt it was important that he get married in front of his close family and friends.
Like, it's another way to show your love and your appreciation and to acknowledge your partner in front of the people that have been in your life.
Luke's sister says she was unsure if she'd ever see this wedding.
A few months ago, we didn't know he'd ever get to be legally married in Australia, so the fact that today he'll have a husband is pretty incredible.
Oh, please don't cry.
The couple are putting off their honeymoon until later this year. They're both in the midst of preparing for the 2018 Gold Coast Commonwealth Games.
On the other side of the country, Gillian Brady and Lisa Goldsmith got in early too, in a midnight ceremony open to the public.
I know you have been waiting a long time for this. You may now kiss your wife.
While same-sex marriage was legalised after last year's yes vote, most couples had to hold off for a month after lodging their intention to wed. Not keen on waiting any longer, Michelle Edwards and Zoe Nolan were up at the crack of dawn getting ready for their big day, walking down the aisle one at a time and into married life.
Yeah, we're so glad that it's actually happened.
And to be able to do it on a first day, such a historic day to do it.
And while some couples' vows were more light-hearted than others...
Felicity, do you promise not to load the dishwasher the wrong way or make Jenny always choose the restaurant?
I do.
All were overjoyed as they finally got the paperwork they'd been hoping for.
Just feeling on top of the world, you know, that we're now legally wives, spouses. I mean, how good is that?
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is.
Another widely covered wedding in the media was of LGBTIQ activists Anthony McManus and Ron Van Houwelingen in Melbourne, and video grabs of their wedding were also shared widely on Facebook. Here they are on Facebook in the back of the limo as the excitement was building, both beautifully dressed in blue suits, white shirts, red bow ties on the way to the ceremony. So, baby, when I get my hands on you, I won't let go. Here's how Channel 9 in Melbourne covered the wedding.
They've been together for three decades, and this afternoon, Anthony and Ron became husband and husband. On day one of same-sex partners being legally allowed to marry, they joined couples across Australia to say their vows...
Thank you for loving me.
..and tie the knot.
You are both legally married!
We've been waiting for a really long time. It feels amazing. It just feels great.
It's far from their first wedding ceremony. They've held many others at rallies and on TV, but it is their first service that's legal.
This is our 17th ceremony and our last ceremony because today it's real. I'm really married.
Among the crowd of family and friends, many fellow campaigners who had hit the streets and pressured government for marriage equality.
Ron and Anthony have been at the forefront of the struggle for so many years.
You can't help but be swept up by the passion and the love and the agenda of equality.
To celebrate two men who epitomise love, in my opinion, it's beyond words.
Ron and Anthony decided to get married here in this Paran Theatre because this is where they met 30 years ago when they were both drama students.
Perhaps the most touching part of the ceremony were the vows exchanged between the two, recorded here by one onlooker on a live Facebook feed.
Ron, I've had to write vows before, but writing these ones was difficult because these are the most important. These will be the last. When people write their vows, they talk of beginning a life together. But we've already been together for 30 years. They talk about looking after each other in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, in good times and in bad. But we've already been doing that. And with the support of our friends and family, we will continue to do that. Thank you for loving me, for taking care of me during the difficult times, and for making me the luckiest man in Australia. We are standing in the theatre where we rehearsed plays all those years ago. Little did we know that we would be here today. After rehearsing for this moment so many times at ceremonies that weren't legal and didn't stick, today, this one sticks. I'm so proud of you, and I'm so proud that I'll be finally able to properly call you my husband. Ron, together we fought for this, and darling man, we won.
Yeah.
Anthony, for all these years, I have loved you. Yet when I look into your eyes, they still smile back at me from the face of a cheeky 23-year-old that I stole a kiss from this school's library. For all these years, I have loved you. But I promise to continue to grow with you, cry with you, and laugh with you, even when I've heard the joke before. For all these years, I have loved you, and our path hasn't always been straight and easy, but you have become my travelling partner, even when we don't know where we're going. For all these years, I have loved you, but I will work to continue to surprise you, because that's what our love looks like. For all these years, I have loved you, and with each new one ahead, I will love you more.
I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, for This Way Out.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Sarah Sweeney and Michael LeBeau, produced by Steve Pride, Joy 94.9 Jock Ben Hall, and Barry McKay. Bette Midler, ABBA, and Elton John performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Prentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Plus. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Q Radio Bangalore, India, WHRW Binghamton, New York, Free Radio Asheville, Asheville, North Carolina, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the midst of the Civil War, while President Lincoln waffled over the Emancipation Proclamation, slaves were already freeing themselves in a massive jubilee. The great historian W.E.B. Du Bois called it the General Strike of the Slaves. And today's guest argues that the self-emancipation of the slaves set in motion, or gave new life to, other liberatory struggles. In Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All, published by Verso, David Roediger looks at how the self-liberation of African-American slaves gave women, Native Americans, wage workers, and others a sense of emancipatory possibilities during what he calls the most liberating and important period in U.S. history. Roediger is professor of American Studies and History at Kansas University, and his many books include The Wages of Whiteness. David, the conventional history of the Civil War holds that slavery in the U.S. ended from on high, as the slaves were freed by Lincoln. What do you think is missing from that story?
Well, I think there's always been a counter-narrative to it. I think that African-American historians in particular talked about emancipation from below for a very long time now. But that's what's missing, is the participation of slaves, the leadership of slaves. When the war started, Frederick Douglass very bitterly called it a war to preserve slavery on both sides in his abolitionist paper, Douglass's Monthly. And what he meant was Lincoln didn't want to free the slaves if he didn't have to. Thought that the war was about union. The Confederacy clearly didn't want to free the slaves, was fighting for slavery as a way of life. So Douglass had this really bitter characterization of the war early on. But then at the same time, he had this quote where he said, this time I think we're to be freed not by the captain, but by the crew. And what he was reflecting on was that even though the kind of on high position early in the war was that the abolition of slavery immediately was impossible, Douglass knew slaves would see the war as being about their own freedom. And sure enough, within days after the start of the war, enslaved people started to find their way to Union encampments, and they'd present themselves to rank-and-file soldiers, and then the rank-and-file soldiers would have to decide what to do with them, and in enough cases, the rank-and-file white soldiers brought them to a commander, and all of a sudden, this was a problem for the war effort. So it was that motion of enslaved people toward what they thought the war was about, toward making the war about freedom, that really transforms the war from something that didn't have a moral mission to something that was about emancipation.
Well, what did that self-emancipation of the slaves look like at that time, both as it relates to the Civil War itself and on plantations and in the workplaces where these people were?
The great first historian of this process is W.E.B. Du Bois, and Du Bois called this motion of hundreds of thousands of slaves the general strike of the slaves. And when we think of general strikes, we usually think of something that's official and called, or if it's spontaneous, it's based in a labor movement. This was much more cobbled together than that, but it involved, Du Bois thought, between 500,000 and 1 million enslaved people out of 4 million who made their way to freedom in one way or another. But then Du Bois added something really important, and he said that the millions of people who stayed on the plantations also were part of the general strike insofar as they refused to do work in the same way that they had done work in the past. And often their master's sons were off at war, or their lives were disrupted in many ways, so that the old way of bossing slaves was also not there. But the idea of the experience of the general strike of the slaves is both these people who left the plantation and people who refused orders on the plantation. And in both those ways, the Confederacy was deprived of labor and was deprived of spirit, of the idea that they knew how the world worked. And a lot of masters thought their slaves were sure to be loyal, or at least professed to think that their slaves were sure to be loyal. So that there was this real crisis created by enslaved people.
Give us some stories, because your book, Seizing Freedom, does draw on historical records of accounts of the self-emancipation of slaves. Give us some examples of what this looked like on the ground, on plantations, and beyond.
Well, for example, the most courageous, wrenching decision to run was made by enslaved women, because for two reasons. One is that they often had childcare responsibilities on the plantations, and to leave without a family was hard, and to leave with a family was hard. The second reason was that commanders of the Union Army very quickly decided that they preferred to have male enslaved people come over to their side, because they could put them to work in a way that was legible to the army. So the most dramatic stories for me are the women who steal their mistress's dress and then also steal themselves at the same time. This kind of motion out into a world where you don't know and you're exposing yourself to all sorts of dangers and really leaving a whole way of life behind. So those stories are very, very dramatic stories. The stories of Harriet Tubman rescuing slaves are very dramatic stories. The story of Robert Smalls, the South Carolina boat pilot who steals a ship in disguise, makes his way and takes advantage of the skills that he had as an enslaved boat pilot to bring not only himself to the Union Army, but the ship also to the Union Army. The songs that surrounded it were very dramatic. A song like No More Auction Block, which Dylan still sings from time to time in concert, was kind of the first history of emancipation. And slaves sort of announced all of the things that they were getting rid of: driver's lash, auction block, but also peck of corn, no more rations, no more ability to know where your next meal was coming from. So the drama is captured in a in a thousand little situations.
Tell us more about what happened to the slaves who then joined up with the Union Army and how that changed during the course of the Civil War.
But the original response of Lincoln and of most of the generals was to say this, to still say, this is not a war of emancipation, so you can come here all you want, but that still doesn't confer freedom on you. So the word that was used to describe these people who had fled over to the Union camp was contraband, in the same way that if you captured a pen full of Confederate pigs, they would be contraband. They would be property seized in the course of a war. And so that's all the more that slaves were, until pretty deep into the war, they were just property still, but now property in the hands of a Union commander. They were often asked to dig in battlements. My friend Andrew Zimmerman is doing a fantastic book on German radical immigrants and enslaved people as agents of emancipation in the Civil War. And he has this history of how the Mississippi River was re-engineered using formerly enslaved labor to enable Confederate blockades to be circumvented, so that there was this whole part of the war that we don't yet know very much about, in which the Confederate blockade wasn't unsuccessful because it was attacked, but it was unsuccessful because enslaved people built a channel that ships could use instead of the normal channel of the Mississippi. So there are all of these ways in which early in the war, it's the labor of the enslaved person that is critical, and then the denial of labor to the master. So both those things go together and are big, big plus for the Union Army. But as time goes on, it becomes more and more clear that the South is putting up a fight. And the biggest gain that the Union can have is to emancipate the slaves and to use them as soldiers and sailors. And so in the latter part of the war, over 100,000 formerly enslaved people directly fight on the Union side.
Tell us more about the way that the slave owners and then those elites in the North, obviously with different interests, reacted to the turning of the world upside down. I mean, this sense of this whole group of people who had been oppressed, throwing off their shackles, and then the whole sense of a potential to do more. How is that received? With absolute fear?
Particularly on the part of the slaveholders. And again, it was not just that the slaveholder was losing property, but was losing a world. And use that phrase, a world turned upside down. For the slave master who had convinced himself, the slave mistress who had convinced herself that they knew their slaves, or that their slaves had an emotional attachment to them and their slaves were loyal, to then find out that their slaves had gone and had taken whatever they could take with them when they left. That was a tremendous, tremendous blow. In the North, the impact of a world being turned upside down is, I think, really interesting, because all of a sudden, the big impossibility in U.S. politics was to have immediate, uncompensated, unplanned emancipation of 4 million people. Abolitionists had sometimes called for it. They'd never gotten any traction politically in gaining support for that idea outside of the African-American community and handfuls of heroic whites. But once that happened, then people could think about all sorts of other things that might happen. And so it was a fearsome thing, yes, for elites in the North. And conservative newspapers, for example, were very, very loath to open the door to emancipation, partly because they knew that it would create desires for emancipation in the rest of the population also.
David Roediger is my guest. He's a historian and the author of Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And in fact, David, your book Seizing Freedom is really about what gets set in motion by the self-emancipation of the slaves, not just in the South. And you argue that this, what you call radiating impulses toward freedom, really transform and challenge much of American society. I wonder if you could talk about how it affected the women's movement, those striving for women's suffrage. And you write that just in the same way that the idea of immediate uncompensated freedom of the slaves was seen as totally in the realm of what was impossible, that similarly women's suffrage was seen in the same way.
Yes, if there were kind of a craziest, the second craziest thing in antebellum politics, it would be votes for women. In 1848, we sometimes talked about as the first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls in upstate New York. The 300 delegates there, presumably the white women most on fire about the idea of women's freedom, they almost couldn't bring themselves to pass a resolution in favor of women's suffrage. And by some accounts, Frederick Douglass had to be brought in to kind of remind American feminists at that convention that sometimes you need to demand things that aren't immediately on the horizon, that seem impossible, but that are morally right. So some progress was made in the 1850s, but it was still in the realm of the impossible that you could envision universal suffrage, even for white women.
So how did then these radiating impulses change the women's movement and reshape it? As you've mentioned, there were obviously links between some abolitionists, like the former slave Frederick Douglass, and the women's suffrage leaders preceding the Civil War. But what happened in the wake of this general strike of the slaves?
And it really is in the wake of the general strike of the slaves, not so much in the wake of just the war by itself. Early in the war, leading American feminists were so steeped in abolitionism, which was their cause as well, and a cause which in many cases gave women activists their first chance to speak in public. It was about that kind of overwhelming moral issue that and Indian displacement that white women began to claim the right to speak in the public sphere because of the overwhelming importance of the brutalities that they were addressing. So women like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, when the war started, they didn't immediately act. They took the position, much like Garibaldi took in Europe when Lincoln asked Garibaldi to bring an Italian regiment on behalf of the Union. And he said, this isn't a war about freedom. I'm not going to do it until there's emancipation. I'm not going to talk about it until there's emancipation. Well, Stanton and Anthony said the same thing, that they supported the war effort, but they weren't going to make a feminist case for the war until it became an emancipatory war. As the Emancipation Proclamation approached taking effect, they formed a group called the National Loyal Women's League, which was to support the war effort. And it actually, its symbol was a black man, apparently, in the way it's pictured, throwing off shackles. So the first organized, what the kind of proto women's suffrage feminist group in the United States actually had an enslaved person throwing off shackles as its own symbol.
You made the point that the women's movement was energized by the self-emancipation of the slaves. But just backing up for a moment, how did the Civil War itself change gender relations for white women and men?
Well, in many ways, women were thrust into occupations or managerial roles on farms and in businesses that they had never had before. They, of course, had even more responsibilities within households and where child-rearing was concerned, just because there was such a wholesale movement of male labor into the Army, both in the North and in the South. So the South is a very dramatic example where you have slave mistresses running plantations in many cases in ways that they would have known how to do and done sometimes, but ideologically, nobody would have acknowledged in the 1850s that a slave mistress was capable, or slave mistresses in general were capable of running the plantation. That happened in a lot of northern businesses. It happened in many, many, many northern farms. So there's that. There's this kind of change in economic roles that women north and south underwent. But then there's also this kind of emotional labor that healing labor that's taken on by women. One of the points of the book is that we know about the 600,000 or so deaths to soldiers and sailors in the Civil War. We talk less about the fact that more people were disabled than died. And I think if we thought about post-traumatic stress in a kind of a modern way and thought about what kinds of toll emotionally was taken on soldiers, that it would be many, many more people were disabled than died in the Civil War. And the responsibility for nursing and nurturing those disabled soldiers also fell greatly on women. And one of the Loyal Women's League's activities was to kind of foster that care in support of the war effort. So there's a way in which women's work expands both in traditional ways that we think about labor, wage labor. All of a sudden, all the printers are gone. So you might, in some cities, find women printers much more accepted during the war than not. But also there's this whole realm of disability that was one of the really surprising things about the book for me, was that I found so much to say about the impact of disability in the wake of the war.
Tell us more about that, and how, with so many white men disabled, did it shape the self-perception of whites and others?
If there were a kind of a premise for the U.S. Republic before the Civil War, it was the able-bodied, independent white man. Alone in the world, the United States decided that any such white man ought to be able to vote, that white patriarch had a role not only in owning his farm, in running his family, but also in ruling a nation. So whenever the United States talked about independence from the War for Independence forward, it was talking about this independence that was premised on ability presumed ability for white men in general to run things and to run their own lives. Now all of a sudden you had probably a million disabled white men, North and South, who were not in a position to portray themselves as those able core of the Republic citizens that had been so much what the mythos of the United States was before the war. And in many cases, they turned to their family members who were female, and it was they who were the strength of the family. So women's suffrage grows from these great movements like national conventions and like ties with the abolitionists. It grows truly from those things, but it also grows from all these little interactions in families in which women have more power, more responsibility, more duty, more emotional labor, and make claims on the basis of having those things.
Well, I want to ask you about your argument that the self-emancipation of the slaves is the key factor in all of this that sets in motion other liberatory movements or gives them momentum that they didn't have. Is it possible to separate out the effects of the war from the impact of that self-emancipation? And I ask that because if you look at various other examples in history, sometimes you can find revolutionary upsurges following war, partly because so much is asked of people during war, and partly also because it does upend the established order. And so women's suffrage in Britain following World War One, and so on, that these things are sort of turned on their heads. So how do we separate out the effects of the Civil War itself in all its dislocations and this general strike of the slaves setting in motion all sorts of other things?
I think one way we can see it is in language. Another thing that wars do along the lines that you're mentioning is that they bring together tens and hundreds of thousands of people who would have otherwise never met each other. And so the giant encampments are these incredible places of education and political education, and they're places where often, as you say, radical ideas thrive. But if we think about those camps in the Civil War example, one of the key moments in those camps was that people began in the middle of the war, the army being overwhelmingly farmers and workers. If you had $300, you could avoid the draft. So people are conscious that it's a poor man's fight, as people said at the time. They're in these camps. They have been the people who accept contrabands, African Americans fleeing toward freedom. They're learning things about race. They're sitting around in these camps. Sometimes if they have a German 1848 revolutionary commander, as in many of the Missouri cases, they're reading radical literature in German. But they sit around in these camps, and the discussion that's the most generative, I think, is they begin to say, what would emancipation be for us? And it's that language of emancipation, or sometimes the slaves called Emancipation Jubilee. And so do white workers have a familiarity with Bible verses about Jubilee. And so there'd be these conversations in the camps about what would Jubilee be for me? What would emancipation be for me? And the labor papers, such as they existed in the time, particularly in Detroit and Philadelphia, picked up on this, and they actually invited people to think, to write in and say, what's your emancipation? And overwhelmingly, in the camps, it was that language of emancipation that enabled people to then say, oh, well, we labor too, and our emancipation would be an 8-hour working day. Our emancipation would be to only work 8 hours a day instead of 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. So I don't think, you know, in terms of your question, that one can prove in any kind of scientific way that it's only the emancipation of slaves that prompts this movement. But I think we can see a lot of ways in which the achievement of this impossible emancipation structures the very way that people talk about these things. Marx in the First International, and Marx was a war correspondent, wrote articles for the U.S. press about the Civil War. When the International Working People's Association, Working Men's Association, convened for the first time in London in 1864, so during the war, practically its first words are these ringing words about the emancipation of the working class has to be self-emancipation. And that language of emancipation was something that Marx wouldn't have had, or the people who wrote it wouldn't have had in 1858. It was the experience of seeing 4 million people in the process of emancipating themselves that gave the very language to the way that people were talking about these things.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with historian David Roediger about his book, Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All. That's published by Verso. His other books include The Wages of Whiteness and Class, Race, and Marxism. So what did the labor movement look like in the United States prior to the Civil War, and how was it changed or affected by the self-emancipation of the slaves?
Well, labor movement meant something a little bit different than our modern association of labor just meaning trade unions, or at least until workers' centers and some of the recent developments we've tended to think in my lifetime about the labor movement consisting mostly of the trade unions. There were trade unions in the antebellum, pre-Civil War United States, and in some cities they were important, but usually just for little periods, and then they'd recede again. Or they were important in crafts where skill mattered a lot. You could kind of win things from your employer because there were only so many skilled printers available to do the work, or machinists available to do the work, blacksmiths that you knew how to do. So a weak labor movement, not a national labor movement, a kind of city-based labor movement. And then on top of that, people in unions either voluntarily or through coercion massively enter the army. So by the middle of the war, there scarcely was a labor movement. There were labor newspapers, but there was very little of a labor movement. And it's really during the war that the labor movement creates itself in its modern form. And again, it doesn't create itself specifically around trade unions. It creates itself mostly around these organizations that were called eight-hour leagues, that were kind of mass organizations of labor in any given place that fought for legislation around the eight-hour working day.
And how did this new labor movement then relate to these other movements that were exploding, the momentum of freed slaves and the women's movement in the aftermath of the Civil War?
There's a tragic story to be told, and there's a story that I think ought to be told before the tragedy. The more hopeful story is that during the war years and just after, there was such an upsurge in the labor movement and in these eight-hour leagues. And actually, the eight-hour leagues won in five or six states, at least symbolic legislation providing an eight-hour working day, which was just unheard of. If there's a third more most impossible thing in life in the middle of the 19th century in the United States, that you'd only work 8 hours a day. Nobody in the world worked 8 hours a day. One little neighborhood in Australia had achieved the eight-hour working day around tremendous heat and tremendous labor shortages. But 8 hours was completely unheard of. It wasn't even a demand in most of Europe. And all of a sudden, it becomes this galvanizing mass movement. And during that motion, Du Bois insisted on this. White workers were really learning things about race, and they were not by any means perfect on racial issues, still less perfect on gender issues. But there was this tremendous opening up towards the women's movement and toward black movements, and a kind of a recognition that these three groups were all doing impossible things at the same time. So black workers are invited to the National Labor Union, which is a white group. The National Labor Union takes shape out of all this ferment at the end of the Civil War. And it, for two conventions, has this kind of unheard of opening toward black workers. There are prominent feminists who are able to join the National Labor Union and to influence the labor movement in New York City quite greatly, especially around women's printers. That there's this effort to train women's printers and to bring them into the union. So there's a moment of great hope, and it's a long moment. It's a 2 or 3 year moment. And some working class leaders, especially if they were German Americans, especially if they were land reformers, had also been close to abolitionists. And so people weren't starting from nothing. But there was an awful lot of room for backsliding on every front. When male printers started to say, we don't want to be in competition with female printers, the official labor movement was very willing to acquiesce. When, to take another example from printing, when Frederick Douglass's son, who was a printer, tried to join the International Typographical Union, there was a lot of pushback. Ultimately, there were compromises in that particular case, but the stance of the labor movement became, well, maybe we can have separate labor movements. Maybe we don't need a united labor movement. So there was this kind of tremendous falling out among people who were who seemed to be approaching a kind of working alliance, but who all of a sudden found reasons to quarrel over what were declining resources. And they were people who were also kind of set against each other by employers.
I'd like to ask you more about that part of the story. But before we do, I wonder, since I've been asking you about this story in black and white, other groups are also part of this story. Tell us about how Native Americans related to the freedom struggles of African Americans and how they fit into this story.
Well, some Native Americans were African. Were a lot of mixed race Native Americans who themselves tended to try to make their way to the Union armies, particularly in the part of the country that I'm in now, in Kansas and in Missouri, and coming from Oklahoma. So Afro-Cherokees, Afro-Creeks, people who were themselves in many cases enslaved, join with this kind of general motion of black people toward freedom. The Civil War, I mean, one of the things that was sobering to me about writing this book was how little the openings to freedom were for Native American people, how much the Union cause, for example, executes people for mildly rebelling in behalf of enforcement of treaty rights in Minnesota during the war. And there's very little outcry about that. Again, in the place where I am in Kansas, people talked about and talk about the free state of Kansas and the great battles of John Brown and others to keep slavery out of the state. But the state had actually been Indian territory until the early 1850s, and so the same process that created the Free State of Kansas also accelerated settler colonialism's sway in Kansas. The guns and the military knowledge and the size of the army created by the Civil War also leads to this terrible period in the later 1860s through the 1880s, of the decimation of Indian populations and the fighting of anti-Indian wars. So Wendell Phillips, the great white abolitionist, writes in 1869 in an anti-slavery newspaper about protests that were going on by Native Americans against the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. And the Native population realizes that once the railroad is in, the opportunity to shuttle troops around and to put down rebellions and to seize land and the development of the West is going to be so much greater that they're resisting the railroad in every way possible. And Phillips writes in solidarity with these protests, which involved, in some cases, destroying track, in some cases, attacking workers. And he does so with the realization himself that this is very unfamiliar terrain for him, that there's not really a tradition of African-American, abolitionist, Native American solidarity. And he wishes, he's a pacifist, so he doesn't wish that the violence will attack persons, but he wishes the victory of these attacks on the railroad. And he says this is, in some ways, the most important struggle going on. And then within 2 years, Phillips is back to being kind of a traditional liberal on Indian questions. He doesn't support Indian autonomy. He said there's no movement there that he can ally with that involves support of Native rights. So he goes back to being for Indian citizenship and for certain limited reforms and kind of ignores the actual struggles that are going on in the West.
How does the self-emancipation of African Americans in the Civil War and the sort of heady emancipatory spirit following the Civil War affect the Irish and how they relate to these struggles?
Yeah, I think it's important to break out the Irish still at this point from the white population in general. The Irish are very much fighting the war. They're very involved in being drafted and in fighting the war. And a fair number of them join with Irish liberation in mind. So there are Irish militants who go into the Union Army partly because they're interested in emancipation in a lot of different realms, but also partly because they want to gain experience as fighters and as people who can fight for Irish independence. So the center of Irish nationalism in the world kind of becomes the United States for a moment. There's this abortive attempt to invade Canada on behalf of Irish nationalism in the middle of the 1860s. And so there's that at its kind of leading edge of extraordinarily politicized people who are Irish Americans and who are also often kind of more sympathetic than the rest of the population to land reform and to the right to land for emancipated slaves. But then there's also a tendency within the Irish population. The Irish population had overwhelmingly opposed abolition, had often mobbed abolitionists in the United States. In Ireland, people supported abolition. But when they got to the United States, the combination of right-wing politics and the church and a kind of hatred for what was perceived as elitism among abolitionists and fear of black labor competition combined to make Irish Americans a kind of a bulwark for white supremacy in certain ways. And so in the draft riots in 1863 in New York City, these are draft riots because they're Irish Americans rioting against the draft, but they also end in attacks on black institutions and on black people who are in the streets. And so there's a much more uneven kind of Irish response in which all kinds of new impulses toward freedom are activated, but then some kind of old habits also raise their head.
I'm speaking with David Roediger. He's professor of American Studies and History at Kansas University, and we're speaking about his book, Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All. I'm Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain. So your book traces both the rise of this emancipatory period and then its falling apart. And I want to return to that, but I wonder if you could set the stage by talking about Reconstruction following the Civil War and the backlash against it as the backdrop to fracturing coalitions.
Du Bois's Black Reconstruction has a striking line in it in which he says, if you looked back from 1876, it would be almost impossible to imagine that just 10 years earlier, Americans had believed in human freedom and equality. A rough quoting. And what he meant by that was that he didn't want to dismiss what happened in the war. He didn't want to miss this, what he called magnificent drama of people liberating themselves and then other people changing their minds about what's possible in the world and changing their minds about black people. But then he also says 10 years later, at the end of Reconstruction, you could see that much of that had gone away. And so you see that in a zillion different ways in Reconstruction. The most dramatic and the one that's written about all the time is the seizing of political power by white elites in the South, although often in combination with Northern capitalists, so that the way that white elites, sometimes ex-planters, sometimes not, get back into power in the South is often to give away resources like timber or coal to Northern companies or to kind of agree to be junior partners and managers in Northern enterprises in the South. So you get this motion toward political economic reconciliation between North and conservative elements in the South at the expense of black people. And so what looks like through much of the late 1860s is going to be an experiment, a wonderful experiment in multiracial democracy involving a base of African American voters and some poor whites who are willing to vote with African Americans is smashed. And it's smashed by those big processes. It's also, frankly, just smashed by terror. There's a lot in the book about Ku Klux Klan terror, but also terror committed by groups with scores of other names that had the same project, which was to keep black people out of politics and to keep poor whites from uniting with black people.
So you mentioned earlier that there had been a moment, a prolonged moment, in which coming out of the Civil War, coming out of the emancipation, self-emancipation of the slaves, that there was the interlinking of the various movements and peoples, the freed people, the former slaves, women, and wage workers, and that after that period of time, those fragile coalitions started falling apart. You suggest that this isn't just an issue of historical interest, but in some sense something that we should all take to heart in looking from the present to that time. And I wanted to ask you how you understand the limitations of the unity of those people and the fragmenting of their alliances. Was it something that in some ways was very likely to happen after the energies of that period ebbed away? Could we understand it in any other ways? How should we get a handle on it? Because clearly those divisions, in many ways, never went away.
Yes. This was the biggest challenge of the book for me, of writing the book, was to think about this ebb that followed the upswelling of freedom. And at certain times I thought, well, I just won't write about that. I'll just end on the crescendo and stop there and leave it for other people to figure out the results. I wrote the book. The book essentially is lectures that I've given and honed and researched further, and some things that I've written books about, like the Movement for a Shorter Working Day, but mostly just things that I wanted to, if I got to lecture to a labor school, I wanted to give this lecture. If I lecture to my students, I want to give this lecture. I think it's very, very, this lecture of self-emancipation and radiating freedom is a very, very important topic. But I wasn't going to write a book about it. And then when Arab Spring happened, in talking with students, I found myself predicting that there'd be new eruptions of freedom in unexpected places. And then some of the students would take the next class with me. And by the time of the next class, it wasn't just Tunisia. It was Egypt and Bahrain and then London and Spain and Occupy in the United States. And these students, I think, sort of thought I was a soothsayer. And that I was doing was trying to think about what happens when a group of people unexpectedly does an impossible thing in history, and it does inspire other people, and it's worth our knowing that. It's necessary that we know that. But the problem is that we don't then just go from strength to strength. That some of the old habits, but also old differences in the ways that people are exploited, reassert themselves. So I've become really interested in writing about the question of solidarity. The last essay in my Class, Race, and Marxism book is an essay about solidarity. And in particular, I think it's important that young people who build social movements today and old people like myself, sometimes I think we think that when unity fails, it's entirely our personal failing that made that happen. And one of the things that I tried to get at in the concluding sobering pages of this book is that there is this real structural difference in the way that some groups are treated as opposed to others, and that there's always a kind of a tendency toward solidarity, but also a tendency toward disaggregation and disunity. The best example of this concretely in the book is the very wrenching decision that people had to make about the 14th and 15th Amendments and the inability of the Republican Party to pass a 14th or 15th Amendment that would have given women's suffrage and black suffrage and equal protection for both groups explicitly. And once you got the issue posed in that way, and with the Klan marauding in the southern countryside, it was very logical from Frederick Douglass's point of view for him to say, we take what we can get. We get the vote for black men. We use that as a platform to build broader movements for suffrage in general, and we use the vote to protect people against Klan violence. It was equally logical for Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton to say, hey, you're leaving us behind. We now become the one exposed group, or as they actually put it, we and disabled people become the exposed groups who are rightless in this society. So, you know, I guess my own view is that probably people should have toughed it out on the left for winning all demands together in that instance. As it turned out, black people were only able to exercise civil rights in the area of the country where they lived for another 10 years or so after that, in any case. But that's not to say that there wasn't a logic in Douglass's position, and that this wasn't just a very, very hard kind of political reality that people had come up against.
I think we'll have to have you back. So much more to discuss about that enduring question. David Roediger, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed this.
I've been speaking with the author of Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches American Studies and History at Kansas University, and his other books include The Wages of Whiteness and Our Own Time. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.